Is that one working? Okay, very good. Thank you for coming. It's really a delight. I don't know what you're feeling right now after a week in Chopron. I'm kind of feeling a mixed series of emotions, an incredible sadness that I have to leave. It's been wonderful just to be here and to be a part of your lives in a very abbreviated way, but the experience has been delightful, and I'm so grateful for it. There's another part of me that I think when I hop on the airplane tomorrow afternoon, I'm just going to probably flop down in the seat and not wake up until it lands in Chicago. And I suspect that some of you are feeling that same sense of emotion as well, that, boy, it's kind of like a spiritual mountain peak, and all of a sudden, you know, reality is going to set in, and we're going to be back into the grind of what it is that we do every day. So I have a level of weariness, I suspect. Probably adrenaline is pumping so hard that I'm not sure that I even realize it yet, but I suspect that there is going to be that experience of coming down from the mountain and facing the realities of struggle and ministry and so forth that we all impact. But certainly Chopron for me has been a delightful experience. And it was last year. Last year I was here, and the Lord really used it in my heart last year to really open my eyes to the breadth and the depth of ministry as it's taking place around the world. You know, the majority of my career has been conducted within the confines of North America, be it the United States or Canada. And while God has given us periodic opportunities to kind of stretch out a little bit, we've done work in Korea, in Australia, in New Zealand, and in Europe, I think Chopron has opened my eyes even more because it's exposed me to a lot of what's happening in Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, places that have been opened up in terms of ministry, where the challenge is great, the receptivity to what it is that we do, incredible. People are responding. There's a need that we're obviously meeting. Resources are limited. And so the challenges that confront us are really quite extraordinary. And I think it's probably a combination of all those things that has created probably the greatest burden on my heart as I leave Chopron. The incredible desire to do what it is that we can do together. I'm not of the conviction that I have all the answers that any ministry would require in order to become all that God intended for it to be. But I do know that I have something to contribute, as you have something to contribute. And I think that's the uniqueness and the blessing of the body of Christ, isn't it? That we all can benefit from one another, and we can grow together. And together, the ministries and the emphases of our ministries can be realized, the objectives of our ministries can be realized, and we can share the joy together. I think that's the beauty of it, you know, that we all, one day, we're all going to be enjoying the presence of the Lord together, and all the labor, all the expenditures of energy that we have been involved in terms of our life's ministry will be over, at least in terms of the ways in which we expressed ourselves during those years that God gave us. But certainly the impact of our ministries won't be over. We'll be enjoying eternity, I trust, with people with whom our ministries and our lives have touched. And so I kind of come with a series of mixed emotions, as I'm sure you do. As I leave here today, it's going to be sadness, it's going to be joy for the opportunity, it's going to be a burden for the incredible needs that exist, and an incredible desire to try to do something. How we've expressed, and I say all that to say that how I am attempting to express my desire to continue to share in relationship with you is through a series of things that we're making available, most of which we don't need money for, and so it's not necessarily, we don't look at Eastern Europe and this area of the world. In fact, we don't look at the world at all in terms of a market. My wife looked at me one day and she says, honey, or I looked at her and I said, honey, I never went into this ministry that we're involved in to make money. And she looked at me and she said, and sweetheart, you've been 100% successful. You've been very, very successful. And so But it's not about resources, is it? It's about the opportunity that He grants us to serve. But we're pragmatic enough to realize that we have to have an infrastructure to be able to support my habit and my desire to give as much as I can to help all of you do what it is that God's called you to do. But a couple of things. We gave you a newsletter, which is entitled DMA Online Forums. This is kind of a new venture for us. And basically, it's the attempt that we have made to try to bring people together in a cost-effective way. I mean, Chopron is great, but, you know, Chopron will not take place again until next June. And there's a long span of time between now and June 11th of next year when we'll have the opportunity of getting together again. And so what we have done is we have tried to take advantage of the technology tools that are made available to us. I think this is the most exciting time in the world in which to live and in history in which to live. I really have a passion for revival, and I really believe that God's going to grant us the joy of seeing people in great numbers come to know Christ in the next 10 or 15 years. And I want to be right in the middle of that wave of what it is that God's doing, and I know you do too. That's why we're here. But what it is that I do is try to equip people for works of ministry and to equip organizations to be effective so that they can accomplish mission and vision in the lives of people and so forth. But the Internet has been a marvelous tool, and I think the potential of the Internet even in the future is even going to be that much more significant in terms of its application to ministry. But we have invested this year, our company's invested a significant amount of money to try to take advantage of the capabilities of the Internet in terms of what it is that we do. And we have leased classrooms with a major university system in America. And what essentially you can do to make it all simple is you can, on a particular day at a particular time, you could log on to your browser, your web browser, whatever that might be in your country. You can type in the address of our website, and it will take you to the DMA website. There on the DMA website, there are any number of resources, and we're going to try to even make them more available to you. But one of the things that you'll find on our website is probably 100 or 200 articles that I've written over the last 8 or 10 years on topics relating to development, you know, topics that would be certainly relevant to some of the issues that you're going to be grappling with. And they're all free. All you need to do is just click on them, and they'll appear on your screen. Just press print and, you know, print as many copies as you want. You know, distribute it to your board members or people that you feel would benefit from them. Please take them, and we'll try to continue to provide them in an ongoing way so that you have the opportunity of being able to at least have information that's going to address some issues which typically aren't addressed in some of the theological journals and newsletters and support you may get from support organizations of which you're a part. So hopefully that will help. But the thing that you can do in terms of classroom is you can kind of go into a classroom. In other words, there's a hyperlink, and I think that terminology is familiar to you. You can click on a hyperlink, and it will take you right into a classroom setting. And I can talk to you and teach you and hopefully encourage you and give you some meaningful structure to move next steps as it terms or as it relates to your ministry. We can interact with one another. You can ask questions, and students within the classroom can talk to each other. So it's really kind of an interesting format. And there could be 1,000 people in the classroom. I mean, we could have people in Romania and Bulgaria and Hungary and Ukraine and Siberia. I mean, they could be everywhere around the world. They could be in Australia and New Zealand. They could all be in the same classroom. Now, that, to me, is amazing. I'm sitting in my office with a cup of coffee, you know, in a comfortable environment, talking into a microphone to hundreds of people, if not thousands of people around the world. And that online forum, there's information, that whole newsletter is about the online forum. And it will tell you how to do it, equipment that you need, and so forth. We hope you'll take advantage of it. Really, it's there is a charge, and that charge is kind of a suggested charge. If you can't afford it, don't worry about it. I mean, I'm not going to withhold opportunity for anyone to participate in it that wants to participate in it. If you can contribute anything, it would be helpful. The point is that we pay somewhere between $10 and $15 for every computer that's logged on. So if we have, on a monthly basis, and so if we had 1,000 people logged on, you know, you multiply 1,000 times 15 and then multiply it times 12, it's a fairly significant expenditure. So to the extent that we can participate together by making contributions that would kind of lower that price, for us, it just makes it make it possible for us to make it available to even more people. And so I think you understand the math behind it. It's not a money-making deal, just be assured of that. But there are ways that you could have money transferred. It's basically what we're recommending is $15 U.S. a month or $180 U.S. dollars a year to participate in the online forums. And that's a recommendation. And again, it's not compulsory. But you might say, well, we could give a dollar, you know, a month or $2 a month, and that's fine. Whatever, you know, would be comfortable for you, but the realities are, you know, there are expenses involved, and we have to be somewhat aware of those if we're going to be able to continue. So those are some of the tools that are available. Please take advantage of that. If you've heard me talk about Sue, and so I put a picture in the back page of Sue and me together. So that's Sue, okay? So she really does exist. You can email me if you feel like that would be helpful, if you feel like I have information that would be helpful to you. I will be happy to respond. If everybody does that at Showpron, I'm going to have a lot of things to respond to, so you'll be sensitive to that. And if I don't get back within the 24-hour period in which you might be expecting an answer, please be patient with me. We'll do our best to try to respond to you in ways that would be compatible with your need and reflective of the urgency of your request. So we have email addresses, we have a website. I want to be available. I'm traveling. Our goal this year is to spend at least 4 weeks in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union and Western Europe this year. I'd like to spend more. And pray for my business that it continues to flourish so that I can, you know, fulfill my habit, okay? I just got this habit, you know, I want to, you know, go and travel everywhere and talk to everybody, so I have to, we're just praying that the Lord would bless our business to the point where the resources would be available for me to do that, and I've got people back there working, and hopefully they're making enough money to support my desire to reach out in the ways that God has granted me that opportunity, so. A little bit of history. I know that may be a little boring for you, but I haven't been with all of you all week. Some of you have been with you all week, and it's been such a blessing. And let's pray together and ask that this day might be really helpful. Father, it has been a great experience, Showpron 2004. Perhaps in eternity we'll sit around and we'll reflect on Showpron 2003 or Showpron 2005, as that might occur in the context of your providence, but not for what coming to Showpron meant to us, but what it is that occurred by your Spirit among those of us that were here, the motivation it was for ministry, the challenge to serve you and to trust you in ways that we've not learned to do that. It's such an interesting paradox that we gather information, we gather expertise, we gather the tools that we need, and yet you've placed them in the hands of some vessels that are certainly totally dependent upon you for what it is that you might choose to do with what it is that we know. Grant us wisdom to be able to take what it is that we've learned and to apply it to our situations, because all of our situations are different. And grant us fruit for our labors in terms of transformed lives. And grant us the joy of being able to realize that the labors, the tears, the burdens that we bear are far insignificant to the impact in eternity that our ministries will have in the lives of others. So, Lord, we just commit ourselves to you today. We pray that this informal session, as we just kind of interact more together today, and then try to put it into the form of a structure in terms of a plan, that we might find this to be edifying and encouraging and really motivating and directive in terms of what it is that we really need to do when we leave here. as it relates to the practicalities of building and growing a ministry for your glory. So we just commit this time to you and ask your blessing on it, for we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. I have a series of questions. This is really going to be an interactive session. I suspect that you probably gathered that from my prayer. I've done an awful lot of talking this week, and I probably will continue to do some here today in terms of trying to pull together thoughts that I'm really trying to gather from you. But it seems to me that, and I'm going to at least provide a context for some questions that I'm going to be asking, and then I just want to have you interact in relationship to your own ministries and some of the passions and the desires that you have for those ministries with which God has given you the opportunity of working. I was talking to my friend Philip here from Australia, and he has a burden to really work with a student organization that's really has the potential of making just a gargantuan difference in terms of Australian undergraduate and graduate students. And so, here he faces this incredible challenge, as we all face, and our challenges take on different dimensions, depending upon, obviously, the nature of our ministries. But what I'd like to do is, first of all, just kind of create at least a bottom line assumption that I have presented in the context of this entire week, and that is that the ultimate goal of ministry is transformation. I just really believe that. When I wrote the book Transforming Culture, it really became the basis of an incredible burden that I had, and that is that organizations exist, be it churches, be it student ministries, be it the ministries that you all represent, and they all are different in the context of where you provide your services. But the ultimate goal of ministry is transformation. You know, in our country and in our society, there's a mega church boom. And essentially, it's almost like churches are competing to outdo one another in terms of the edifices that they construct to conduct ministry. And somehow, the context of transformation is lost in the desire to outdo someone else. And while I realize that we wouldn't be that unspiritual to say that that's what we want to have a bigger church than that church, or we want to have more seats than this church, or whatever the case might be, while I know that nobody would actually say that, we'd spiritualize it, wouldn't we? We want to have more seats so more people can come and hear the gospel and go out and transform culture. But I wonder, in reality, if we're not so focused on ministry, and we look at our organizations and we look at our ministries as kind of the end of the energies that we're expending to develop them, and not the ultimate goal for why those organizations, why those ministries were established in the first place. And it seems to me that they were established to impact people, to transform people. And to the extent that people are transformed as a result of what it is, the structure that we provide, and I'm not suggesting that structure is unimportant, but I am saying that to the extent that people are impacted, then communities are impacted. The communities of which they're a part, and communities could be defined in a very limited way. It could be the groups of which they're a part. That ought to be impacted. There should be, I think, and I wrote an article recently called the Fingerprint of Our Presence. And the whole point of the article was, does your world reflect the fingerprint of your presence? If you were to die tomorrow, and all of a sudden the house where you lived is now vacant because you're gone, you have gone on to be with the Lord, would the fingerprint of your presence be evident in the community where you live, the neighborhood, or among the people that surrounded you? Would someone know that you were gone? And it's not necessarily so much the concern that, would they miss you, but would the evidence of your life and your belief and your commitment to God be seen and experienced beyond your actual presence? And, I had to ask myself that question. I'm writing about this stuff, and then I kind of woke up one day, and I was jogging through my neighborhood. Most of you know that I get up and run every morning, and I've been looking for runners all week in Chopron. Now, I had Nick Neglichev for a while that ran with me, and then he hurt himself. Next year, I want to challenge you. Bring your running gear. We'll have a little running club. So, Paul, next year, let your week, that you run, be the Chopron week. Paul says he has a habit of running. It's 2 weeks a year, 50 off, 2 weeks, 50, 2 weeks, 50. So I thought he's a pretty good program. So let one of them be next year, show prime. We'll do it all together. We'll just kind of jog out, and we can talk and share and visit with one another. That's always kind of fun. But I was running through my neighborhood. Now, you know what most of my neighbors think? They think Jerry's a nice guy. I mean, because I'm running down through, and hey, how you doing? Hi, how you doing? Hi, how you doing? You know, they're walking, you know, I'm visiting, I'm waving, you know. I don't even know their names, but I know their faces, and I kind of know where they live because I kind of see them walk out of their houses in the morning, and so I'm just running around waving to everybody and so forth, and I think most of them would think that I'm a pretty nice person. Well, you know, as a result of the conviction of God on my heart, I decided that I needed to reach out to my neighbors in a more meaningful way, and so I decided I was going to do a home Bible study. I just went to all my neighbors and said, hey, listen, I would like to get together with people once a, a week or once a month. And, I've written this little book, and I think it's kind of interesting. And I thought maybe we could talk about this book and other things. And we've got Jewish neighbors, and we've got neighbors of other religions that live in our neighborhood and so forth. Well, you know what they said? I mean, almost to a person, they said, well, we'd love to do that. That sounds like it would really be a lot of fun. Well, you know what I discovered? That many of those people, that one of those individuals that I run by every day almost, wave, her husband's dying of cancer, and they're struggling because their family has been dysfunctional for years and years, and now the death of their dad or the impending death of their dad is creating a some interesting interesting family dynamics as they're trying to draw together in relationship and come back together. Another one of my neighbors who actually lives across the street, who I wave to every day as he's walking out to get his newspaper as I'm running by, is a physician who basically has lost everything. He was written up in our city magazine as almost an object of ridicule, a very prominent doctor that was making $5 or $6 million a year and has lost essentially everything. And he walked out, and I talked to him. He was actually amazed that I stopped. I was running, and I actually stopped, and I was visiting with him, and I was telling him about our little, home Bible study and stuff. And he says, well, it's interesting that you would talk to me. He says, we have physicians that live in this town. He began to point out, in this community, he began to point out where their houses are. He says, nobody ever talks to me anymore. And so here are people that are struggling with their issues, and yet we walk blindly past them in an effort to pursue our own vision. And to me, I think that's tragic. And I think we do it in ministry, that we're so concentrating on what it is that, the ministry, that we lose the purpose or the focus of what it is that God's called us to do. So what we're going to do today, or what I'm going to do, and I think I can bring this, hopefully, these are notes that I made over 2 cups of espresso this morning. So, I mean, at least they show the espresso high. I was writing quickly, but let's see if we can answer some questions and kind of interact with one another. I would like this to be an interactive session. That's a method of teaching that I'm not particularly good at. Yeah, I'm a great lecturer. I think I can talk about a lot of things, but it's hard for me to interact, as you perhaps have gathered. But what I would like us to think about, well, first of all, I've made these points. The ultimate goal of all ministry is transformation. It seems to me that we really need to focus on that. That people are transformed, and as people are transformed, the groups of which they're a part are transformed. Or it should be the case. In other words, the people with whom I associate, be it my family, be it the people with whom I work, people with whom I'm associated in terms of ministry, people are transformed, and then the groups of which they are a part of transform, and then communities are transformed. You know, as a result of our impact, entire communities could have, or the potential for being impacted is certainly there. And then as communities are transformed, certainly culture as we know it is transformed. And it seems to me that the ultimate goal of ministry is the transformation of culture, at least in ways that would be consistent with our mission. The other conclusion that we have made in the context of this week, and this is the last instructional piece that I'm going to give before we start asking questions, then we'll come back and try to pull it together in the form of a model or something that could be very practical for you. But it's my belief that transformation, if it occurs in the life of an individual or a group or whatever, transformation is going to be measured in terms of our ability to build relationships with others, that true transformation occurs within the context or in the environment of relationship. You know, relationships are words, or that's a word that we're all familiar with. If I were to ask you, in fact, let's kind of think through this. It'd be kind of fun to have you respond to this. But when you think of a precious relationship, think of the most precious relationship you enjoy in life, or maybe it's a combination of things that would come to your mind, but think of, you know, an individual or a group with whom you're in relationship, and you really feel a part of that group. In other words, you don't feel like an outsider, you feel like a participant in what it is that they're doing. As you think about that, what would some of the words that would come to mind that would reflect and articulate why that relationship is so precious? What would be some of the words that you would think of in thinking about that special relationship that would immediately come to mind? Value. You know, that I feel that I have something to offer, and they feel I have something to offer in terms of the relationship, and my presence, my involvement is valued. Okay, very good. Other things. Words. Love. You feel love. And okay. Pardon me? And have the opportunity of expressing love to others. Okay. All right, what other words, as you think about relationships, think of an organization, if you were to look at your church, because I think, you know, we do have relationships, and whether they're satisfying or fulfilling relationship is going to be predicated on how you're responding to it, and whether or not you're actually invited or you feel invited to participate in what it is that God's doing there, which in some instances we don't, do we? And so the relationship, you know, that environment which kind of precipitates and facilitates change doesn't exist, and so we feel more a victim than we do a participant, you know, a target, if you please. And I wonder if we're as effective as we possibly could be in terms of relationship if we're really a target of someone's intention and not necessarily a participant, a co-participant in what it is that God's doing. Interesting thoughts. Okay, other words that would come to mind in describing, you know, the ideal relationship. Excuse me? Sharing, that you feel free to share. Yes. Okay. That, and maybe forgiveness in terms of, and I'm not sure that these two terms are synonymous, but certainly they're related, and that's acceptance. That, you know, we're not perfect. We don't enter into relationships perfectly. Yeah, that's right. There's a restoration characteristic that seems to be apparent in long-term sustained relationships, which involves forgiveness, and it involves a whole lot of other things. you know, families, you know, disagree, but there's something that even in the context of disagreement in relationship that makes a relationship work. In other words, we feel honestly that we feel safe in a relationship, don't we? That regardless of who it is we are and how bad we may be or how uninviting or accepting that we feel ourselves to be at any given time, that we feel safe in a relationship that regardless of that, that somehow we're still going to be accepted and that we can be forgiven, we can ask and seek forgiveness and so forth. Yeah, those are some interesting thoughts. Other things that come to mind? Yes. United. Exactly. We feel there's commonality that brings us together. And while it may not be uniform, in other words, we may not agree on everything, there's some core value that kind of brings us together. And that core sensitivity kind of keeps us together. And while we all have our differences, and that's what makes, you know, relationships interesting. If we were all the same, you know, everything would be rather boring. But the fact that we are different, but there is something common that binds us together. Other thoughts or words that come to mind? Pardon me? Oh, yeah, same goal. In other words, there are common goals, not necessarily in every area, but there are some common goals. I think relationships, you know, quite frankly, you know, it's rather mundane, but I think they're enjoyable. I mean, fun would be a word that I would use, but I'm not sure that expresses it well. But you kind of gravitate to people that you're in relationship. You just really want to be with them. I mean, you find yourself walking down the street, and there's your friend across the street. You just kind of want to cross the street. You want to make that extra effort to try to be with them, because you find a level of enjoyment just in the presence of someone. So I think my relationship with Sue, for example, you know, it takes an awful lot of dimensions. But, you know, she's the person that I enjoy being with the most in life. We could go someplace and never say a word, and I think both of us in some instances would be totally, you know, fulfilled by the experience that we're just together, and there's something about that in relationships. Who benefits from a relationship? That's not a trick question, by the way. I mean, but I do want you to respond to it. It's mutual. I mean, we benefit and they benefit. If it wasn't reciprocal, then the realities are it wouldn't be a relationship, would it? In other words, if and exactly, I think that's where the context of manipulation comes into the process, does it not? Because, you know, people are pretty intuitive. And we can talk about relationships, especially in ministry. You know, as a pastor, we can say, you know, we really want everybody to have relationships. But if the purpose of the relationship is to fulfill my agenda, and we realize that that's the means through which my agenda is going to be fulfilled, or if I'm going to pursue you because I know you have a lot of money, and I realize that if you were to part with that sum of money, or some of that money, our ministry might be enhanced and be able to grow. And so to the extent that we pursue people for what it is that we can gain to satisfy our needs from them, and there's not the opportunity for reciprocation on behalf of the person with whom that's not a relationship. And that really does reflect, I think, a level of manipulation. And I think manipulation, we all can think of it in terms of money, and I think probably one of the reasons why my profession has been somewhat disdained, you know, in certain environments is because I think, you know, many times people that are quote-unquote fundraisers, and I never have construed myself as being a fundraiser. I always hate it when people introduce me as a fundraiser. Here's Jerry Twombly, and he's a fundraiser, and I always get aggravated when people, as soon as that's said, they kind of step back about three steps, you know. Then they start, you know, searching for their billfold. They want to make sure that everything that's valuable to them is protected because they know that, you know, something I might say may take them away. Paul, you had a comment. Yeah. You know, the interest of think about, because that causes me to think through something else, which I think is relating to what it is that you're saying. And I don't know where the idea of selfishness comes in a relationship. You know, there's a part of a relationship that you feel selfish about. You don't want to share with anybody else because you don't want anybody else to experience what it is that you're experiencing. But what you're experiencing from the relationship, so you want to hold it to yourself. And there's certain relationships where that certainly is appropriate. But I've been a part of other groups, you know, where I've experienced relationship, but the group, you know, has been embracing. You know, there's something attractive about the group that other people, and they embrace others in much the same way that they may have initially embraced me. And then collectively, there's kind of a group dynamic that comes into play that is, you know, rather intriguing. And that dynamic enables effective things to take place. We have that in kind of cell group situations in our church, you know, where, you know, two or three of us got together, and we were having fun, and we were enjoying ourselves, but then other people were drawn to the group, you know, because they wanted to be a part of it. And I think it was really appropriate the way our group responded to those people. We embraced them, and they became a part of what it is that we do, too. And that dynamic is really kind of interesting. And it seems to me that that's almost a spiritual activity as much as it is a, you know, a proactive initiative on behalf of the participants, that God does something, and maybe it's the attractiveness of God that attracts them to the group. I'd like to think that that's true. That's interesting. They're reciprocal. The question now becomes, and this is really the challenge. I mean, this is certainly one question that I would have us to respond to, and I'm not sure that we're going to be able to do it all, you know, real objectively, but would the people that support your organization financially, do you think they would use those same words to describe their relationship with you? In other words, they're a supporter, but do they feel in relationship with you in the ways that we describe that relationship? The targets, quote unquote, for lack of a better term, but the focus of our ministry in terms of people, the people that come to our retreat center, the people that come to our student ministry, the people that come to our church, the people that are basically the focus of our intention as an organization to impact, you know, in the ways that our ministry was intended to do that, would they use the same words to describe their relationship with you and the organization that you represent? That they sense that reciprocal sense of relationship, you know, they benefit, you benefit, they feel a part of things and so forth. And it seems to me that while those things, and this is always the challenge in the kinds of things that I do, but while those things, you know, are the desires, the ultimate desire of ministry, that we can create the environment where relationship exists because we realize that the success of our ministry is going to be related to, you know, somewhat proportionate to our ability to be able to build that kind of environment or to create that kind of a relational environment. You know, the question is that it might happen, but is there a sense in which we might be more proactive in facilitating that? And that's where, you know, in the context of what it is we do as servants of the Lord, that's really where it becomes a challenge from my perspective. Because there's a part of that that says, well, that's the dynamic of God, so we should let God do that, and we just kind of participate. And in doing so, we kind of wash our hands of responsibility and hope that God's going to work all things out, which, you know, he does, and or he can. But to what degree do we need to be proactive participants in the process? Right. Exactly. And that's such a good point because, you know, whether somebody gives you a gift or not, you know, that's one thing, you know, that they might make a gift. The real measure of how effective, in many respects, your organization is in development is going to be reflected in the fact of their continued involvement, you know, either financially or in a variety of other ways. In other words, it's not the first gift that's the important, it's the sustained involvement and support of organizations or individuals in support of your organization that's going to determine whether or not you've really been successful. And what, you know, think about that. Well, how would you, you know, because if you have an organization where you have 100 donors or 50 donors, or maybe you have 1,000 donors, or in the case of some of the organizations that are represented here, I know that UCCF, for example, the student ministry in UK, you know, I was looking at some information that they gave me. They have 40,000 people on their database. Wow. Now, how do you build relationships with 40,000 people? You know, let's assume that 1,000 or 2,000 or let's say 10% of those people are donors or have been donors in the past. How do you sustain meaningful relationships with those 4,000? But don't you think that the impact of our ministry is going to be predicated to some degree on how well we do that or if in fact that actually happens? That's the question, by the way. Let me rephrase that because you're all looking like, or is that a statement or is that a question? Do you believe with me that the ability of our ministry to fulfill its function will be predicated to some degree in how well we build those relationships? I think it does involve that. How would you do that? As you think about your organization, you know, let's just arbitrarily think of, you know, think of whatever your ministry represents, and you've got, you know, 50 people out there that are giving to you. They support you financially. Now you're sitting in your office and you're trying to figure out ways that you could meaningfully build a kind of reciprocal beneficial relationship, you know, between those individuals and your organization. What would be some of the things that you could do practically? Okay. Okay. Well, let's. I think you make a very important point, and let's try to pick up on that a little bit, because the first question I asked you was what? You know, think of the words that you would use to describe the ideal relationship. And you all came up with wonderful words that, you know, you could relate to, because as you were thinking of people and as you were thinking of organizations, those were the words that you would use to describe how and why that feels so special to you. What happened in relationship? Now, you know, think of your spouse, think of whatever relationship you were thinking about, but what happened, you know, in that relationship that created or allowed you the opportunity or motivated you to say the word that you said? In other words, there was something that occurred that in the context of that relationship building, or there were a number of things that occurred. What were some of the things that occurred that have resulted in relationship? I'll give you an example just to get you started on it, okay? Because I'm sure that the question, I'm not all that good about asking good questions, I guess, but one of the things that I could think of is that is sharing. You know, Sue and I, you know, just began to share our hearts with one another when we were courting, you know, and I asked her, and a part of it was sharing, but a part of it was responding to questions. You know, and Sue's a psychologist. I think I probably told you that, or at least some of you knew that. She's a pretty brilliant lady, and she's had a clinical psychological practice for years, and I guess the Lord knew I needed to marry a psychologist because I have no idea. I always tell people, never marry a psychologist, because closure is not in their vocabulary. You know, that's really frustrating to me. The closure is not in the vocabulary of a psychologist. See, I make my living trying to bring closure to problems. I go into organizations that are dysfunctional, and they ask me to come in, and they say, okay, help us to deal with this. And so I say, well, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this, and you need to do this. And they say, well, Jerry, thank you very much. We can do this, that, and the other thing. And so I try to bring closure to a lot of things that have just been kind of bleeding for a long time. But Sue's attitude is totally different. She says, you know, a psychologist uses the word process. And so, you know, we're always processing. We're always kind of working towards closure, but it's kind of a never-ending thing. We've had arguments that have gone on for years. I mean, 15, 20 years. Disagreements, things that we don't quite see the same way. And I looked at her one day after 10 or 15 years of grappling with something and said, well, honey, maybe we got to bring some closure to this. She says, oh, no, it's going great. We're really making some great progress through process. That's real annoying, but nonetheless, I think you know where I'm going. But we grew in our relationship through sharing, didn't we? And so sharing, I think you brought up a point. You know, you share through telling stories anecdotally of people that have been impacted by your ministry through newsletters. And sometimes when you have people all over the country or all over the world, then obviously that becomes a challenge. Let me give you a couple of examples of how other organizations have shared that have been impacting. One of our ministries that we support is Habitat for Humanity, and Habitat for Humanity builds homes for people, and I think you're probably pretty familiar with the organization. What they do on an annual basis from an organizational standpoint, I always thought this is really kind of neat. But they have the families that move into Habitat homes, Habitat calls them partner families. In other words, they buy those homes, by the way. They're not given to them. They purchase the homes. They buy them interest-free for whatever it costs, and usually less than what it costs to build them. And so there's a sense of ownership and pride, you know, that people take in the fact that they now have their own home and it's theirs, you know, that they've actually purchased it, you know, through a program that, you know, works in the societies and the cultures where they live. But one of the things that they do, at least in America, which I think is really neat, around Christmas time, you know what happens is that people that are donors to Habitat for Humanity, some of these partner families will just call them at Christmas on the telephone. And they'll say, you know, I'm so-and-so, and I live in a Habitat home. And I'm just calling you. I know you've been a contributor to Habitat for Humanity, and I'm just calling to thank you. Because if it wasn't for you and lots of people like you, you know, I wouldn't be able to have the home that I have. And, And then they'll tell a little bit of their story, but, you know, the purpose of my call is just to thank you for being a part of what it is that we do, or what it is that Habitat does, because it's impacting people, and I'm one of those people. Well, you know, you kind of hang up the phone, you kind of feel, you know, a little bit warm, you know, that realize that your gift was not just something that somebody forgot, and the building was built, and, you know, they're going on and seeking to develop relationships with other people to get more money so that more houses can be built. But they essentially make that person, practically speaking, a partner. And the sharing, which is really the essence of newsletters, it's really sharing, and we want to see if there's ways that we might be able to do that more intimately rather than, you know, coldly. I mean, you get newsletters. Well, I get 50 newsletters a month from organizations because I ask to be on everybody's mailing list. You know, please put me on yours, too, by the way. But I want to get information from you. But I get a lot of newsletters, but I don't feel warmth necessarily towards all the organizations from one that I receive information from, which we could ask the question, well, what gives you warmth? You know, why would you pick up one as opposed to another? Why would you pick up one as opposed to another? Okay. Right. Right. Yeah. One of the analogies that I use a lot in talking about relationships is marriage and falling in love, because I think it is a great example. And I began thinking the other day, I was just drawing this on a sheet of paper the other day as I was, you know, flying someplace, and I'm kind of a graphic person, so I have to think about things graphically. But I began to think about, and I think I've kind of shared this with you. Let me suggest that this is an example of a courtship. And it seems like there are points of decision, and I'm sure that there are more than the four that I've just indicated there by those X's on those arrows. But it seems to me that, you know, here are two people, you know, that are kind of they're single, they're looking in terms of, you know, they desire to, you know, live in a relationship with someone else and marry and to, you know, spend their lives together doing things together that they would not be able to do perhaps with the same level of impact that they could do alone. So here's you know, here's Sue and here's Jerry, or here's a donor prospect and here's your organization. And there came a point in time somewhere here where I looked at Sue and I talked with Sue in some kind of an informal setting. I mean, we weren't on a date or anything, but I talked and we were kind of determining, you know, whether or not I suppose when I look back at it, you know, I think I was probably looking at Sue and there was probably something running through my mind that, well, she's attractive, she's intelligent, she's witty, we share a lot of the same things. And then I began wondering, well, I'd like to get her to know her a little bit better. And so I asked her, you know, for a date, and she said yes. And so we went on a date, and we had a good time. It was really a lot of fun. Now, I've been on, you know, when I was single, I'd gone on a lot of dates, and I went on one date, and it never went on from there, right? We just said, well, gee, that was fun, and, you know, we kind of go on, and we don't necessarily pursue it. But I asked Sue for a second date, and she said yes to that. But see, there's a sense in which there's a, you know, an increasing level of commitment at every one of the steps along the way. There came a point in time, and I says, well, you know, I'd like to take you up to Maine where I live, and I'd like you to meet my parents. Well, that's kind of a bigger commitment, isn't it? Because all of a sudden, when we start talking about meeting our parents and talking about, you know, I need you to meet my sisters and I need you to meet some of my friends and so forth, all of a sudden we're thinking, well, man, this is maybe going someplace. And then there's another commitment, you know, where we start talking about, well, you know, if we were to marry, you know, how many children would you want? And, you know, where would you want to live? And what do you feel and sense God's calling you to do and so forth? And all the while, by the way, we're kind of sharing more vulnerably information about ourselves. So there's a certain sense of vulnerability that exists in relationships. There was a book written by a Jesuit A number of years ago, I don't even know if it's in print or not, but if you ever have the opportunity of picking up the book, I'd encourage you to do so. The author is John Powell, P-O-W-E-L-L. And John Powell is a Jesuit, and he wrote this book that was entitled, Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? You've read that book? It's a very interesting book. But the book, basically, the premise of the book is this. If you really want to know Jerry, I can tell you who I am. Now, I present to you what it is that I want you to see me as. I mean, in other words, I present you as a professional, hopefully, successful. I'd like you to think of me as successful, confident, you know, that I know what it is that I'm saying, and I know that these principles work. And so I present to you someone who's professional, kind, perhaps, confident, successful, and so forth. That's the way many of us want those relationships to stop. Because there's another layer here that I may not want you to see. You know, that I'm not as confident as I'd like people to think I am. You know, there's a sense of fear. I have, you know, there's a fear of rejection. And then, you know, you could go down a little bit deeper, and you might find an incredibly insecure person, you know, who grew up in a dysfunctional type of relationship at home and so forth. And so he compensates in a variety of ways in order to be able to deal with that. And sometimes his confidence or his professionalism is really a mask to try to, you know, cover up what's inside that really hurts, and he hasn't been able to really grapple with it. So the point that Powell makes in his book, Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am, is that to the degree that I reveal myself to you, okay, to the degree that I reveal myself to you, there may be a point in time that I reveal something about myself to you that you reject, okay, that you say, I don't want to have anything to do with that kind of guy. And if I have been honest in revealing myself to you in the ways if I tell you who I really am, and if you reject me, I have nothing left to offer you. Okay? I mean, I have nothing left to offer you if I tell you who I am and you reject me. And so a lot of people will never tell you who they are because they don't want to be rejected. And so there's a sense in which we're kind of butting up against facades. You know how we want, and we never get down to real relationships. And when you think of the real relationships that you enjoy in life, the most satisfying relationships, you've been able to get past all of that, haven't you? That my friends, the friends that I call my dearest friends, know me intimately. Sue knows me intimately. She knows my fears. She knows my apprehension. She knows my insecurities. She knows my strengths. And she still accepts me for who it is I am. Can you imagine what would happen if we could do that on an organizational level? So there comes a point in time where we make a commitment. You know, we get to the altar, we exchange vows. But oftentimes what happens in relationship, and you could call commitment a gift, you could call commitment involvement, you know, because commitment takes on a different focus in ministry, doesn't it? People make commitments to ministry. But what typically happens in a lot of marriages, okay, now we're married. We've accomplished what it is that we want. We've got the money that we need. And now we go on living our life. Our spouse goes on living her life. And you have, you know, essentially, if the marriage stays together, it's a dysfunctional relationship. And I think most organizations have a lot of dysfunctional relationships with the people that support them. Now, we've got to take a break. We've got the two-minute warning here, which... you're an American football player, we all take a break and we all go into the huddle and try to figure out what we're going to do in the next 2 minutes. So let's take a break and then we'll come right back as soon as we change tapes. Okay, if we can start gathering together again and we're going to take a break again at about 11. There's a group that's leaving at 11. And so we need to send them off and bless them and pray that, you know, as they go back, I hope we all go back with kind of a little spring in our step in terms of not only we've learned something that's been of real value, but we're going back with a new sense of hope that perhaps in the midst of the challenges that we face on a day-to-day basis, God's going to give us, you know, a new sense of freedom to be able to work and fruit, you know, for our labor. A couple of things just real quickly on relationships, because I want to move away from this, but I think it's really caused us to think about, you know, some of the issues that we need to grapple with. But we were talking about, you know, there's an increased level of vulnerability that occurs as relationships grow, and someone mentioned just as we were leaving, you know, sometimes, you know, we may start revealing, you know, more of ourselves a little bit too soon, and consequently scare people away. And I think, practically speaking, you know, we could think of any number of situations where that might be the case. And we probably know someone who has come to us in some relationship of one kind or another, and is basically, you know, all of a sudden you don't hardly know them, and all of a sudden they're just telling you their deepest, darkest secrets, and you know, you feel uncomfortable because it's almost like they haven't earned the right to be able to tell you those things. And so we kind of back away in that relationship because we feel that that's probably more information than we're capable of dealing with. And so there's a sense in which probably certain pieces of information are withheld appropriately to times when, you know, it's appropriate. And there's a sense of sensitivity, I think, that only God can give us in those regards. And when you're doing it at a corporate level, it becomes a bit more challenging, doesn't it? Because you're not dealing with one or two people, but you're dealing with 40 or 50 or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 people. But there are certain pieces of information, even with that larger group of people, if I, in fact, knew where they were in relationship with me, that I might share certain pieces of information that I wouldn't share with other people. And so I think that brings us back to a lot of the points that we've been dealing with all week, and that is that not everybody on your database, individuals with whom you're seeking to build relationship, is in the same place in relationship to the organization as the person next to them. So one of the great challenges, practically speaking, of development is knowing where people are. Because if you know where they are, you know the level of quote-unquote freedom that you might have in terms of communicating, you know, information about you or your organization or your ministry. So that makes database management, AID, cultivation tools that we introduced to you and so forth, very, very relevant, you know, to this whole process. I want to just, you know, the increasing vulnerability aspects, I think there is a sense in which vulnerability in ministry is appropriate. Let me give you an example of how I've seen it done, and I think it's has been quite appropriate. At Grace College and Theological Seminary, when I served there as Vice President for Advancement, and I think we've probably made reference to this, but we began a program, and the program was called our President's Club. It was a giving program, quite frankly. People were asked to be a partner with us as a member of this President's Club, and these people were giving contributions annually of $1,000. Now, we received, I shared a little bit of this with you in the context of our seminar, but they received a plaque. It had the seal of the school on it, and there was a mention of the individual's name, and then there was the verse of the school, which is Colossians 1:18, and all things that he might have the preeminence. Then there was a little ribbon here that basically said 1998-99, and that was when they made their first gift, and as they made subsequent gifts, these ribbons were added to their plaque. And a lot of people just found, you know, that plaque to be, and you may not see it as being appropriate, but in our particular case, a lot of people really valued these because it reflected that they were a part of something that they took a great deal of pride, I think appropriately, in being a partner with us and helping us to do some things. But that wasn't the focal point, obviously, or their money wasn't necessarily the focal point of that program. We had a kind of a communication schedule, and the communication schedule looked something like this, and I'm not sure I'm going to get it. I haven't reproduced this in a long time, so you'll excuse me if I don't get it right. But when we received the gift, so this is when the gift was received, they received basically a thank you call, you know, from the president. You know, the president called. Now, given the DMA, and for those of you that are kind of new to us, and we've got, most of you have been a part of at least one or two of the seminars or the presentations that I've made, but we have created a planning model, okay? And let me just give you, there are 8 steps in this planning model, and I'm not going to give you all 8 steps, but the first of those steps is profiling a picture of the ideal. In other words, before you plan anything, look at the end result and kind of ask yourself the question, if we were perfect in accomplishing what it is that we would like to accomplish in relationship to this particular individual or this group of individuals or this event that we're planning or this activity that's taking place, if it was totally and 100% successful, you know, how would people leave? What would that person look like? In other words, if somebody comes for a week in Salzburg to the ministry that you represent, and they're you know, if this was a totally 100% successful ministry activity, you know, how would that person leave? Not just blessed, they're coming to a seminar, so they're going to walk away spiritually blessed, but they feel part of a community, they feel like there's kind of an ongoing relationship, that if they had needs, they could be able to interact. There are programs that they could plug in back at home or with the organization. I mean, I suspect that we could come up with any number of things. Well, then when people leave, you know, we do some assessment, don't we? And ideally, we'd like to kind of do some preliminary assessment before they even come, but assess the way we've got this program planned and ask ourselves the question as we're planning the program, are we doing everything that we would need to do to create the environment that we want to create that would result in the results that we want to accomplish? In other words, if you can do a lot of this prior to the event, then I think you're going to... So we need to assess our plans. We need to quantify the deficiencies. In other words, we haven't addressed this issue, this issue, this issue, this issue, and this issue. We need to prioritize those issues that we've recognized as deficient. You know, this is the most important in terms of mission criticalness. This is next, this is next, this is next, and this is next. And then we need to plan. Okay? Now, there are other aspects of that planning model that all of you are familiar with, but certainly these 5 steps are pretty important. Well, I say all of that to say that when the president calls, you know, as the result of this gift, you know, we kind of profile the call. In other words, if this was a perfect call, it wasn't just, hey, thanks for your gift, good hearing from you, God bless you type of a situation. That wasn't the purpose of the call. I mean, the purpose of the call was to thank you, but it was to welcome you to a group that he considered to be very, very important in the ongoing ministry of the seminary to which he was called to lead, that one of the objectives is that we have made agreements as an organization in conjunction with every member of the President's Club. And this is the commitment that we make to you, that we will keep you informed about what it is that's happening on our campus. We will invite you back, you know, to as many events as you feel you have the time and the ability to attend. We will solicit information about you that you might be willing to give that will enable us to have a more effective relationship with you in terms of praying for you and being a part of your life. So basically, you know, we profiled just that little step alone, which I realize is just so mundane at one level, but everything that you do, you know, profile it in terms of what the ideal result would be if, in fact, it was successful. And so the president, we sat down with the president. Now, if you were getting a call from somebody that, you know, you just gave $1,000 to and because you really believe in their ministry, what would you kind of want to hear from them? You know, what would you like them to walk away with? He says, well, I want them to walk away feeling like they're important, that they're an integral part of this whole team that we're putting together to take us where it is we sense God's calling us to go. Well, how would you express that? He says, I'd like to think that I'm more than just a target for them, but I'm, you know, I'm a part of something that I have needs too that I'm hoping that can be met through a relationship with the university or with the seminary. And so he's asking for their prayer request, you know, and basically, from an administrative level, you know, many times in administration meetings, he'd come with, 5 or 10 requests from some of our major donors and some of the key people that were supporting us, and we'd just pray for them, and he'd call them periodically and let them know that they've been prayed for. Okay, so that was the first communication. 3 months later, and we tried to do this in cycles, and the beauty of database management or computers is that you can get these on a calendar pretty easily. But 3 months later, they received a very personalized letter from the president. And actually, we call it, insider or something like that. It had a name, and it was the letter was addressed to the individual, Dear Jerry and Sue, and very, very personal. And I would write those letters every month. In other words, they were cyclical. I mean, a group of those letters were going out every month, given the fact that people were enrolling into that program on a monthly basis. But in the third month, we made sure that everybody got, a letter that was unique to them. You following me? I think so. Okay. But what I'd do is I'd go and I'd sit down with the president, and I'd say, what are the reasons why you do what it is you do? I just ask him questions. I'm trying to uncover a little bit about his personality. He's an academician. He writes books. He's a theologian. He's an exegete. He doesn't tend to reveal an awful lot about himself. And I'm trying to really understand him and grow in my understanding and appreciation of him about what it is that motivates him, what it is that keeps him in this ministry, why would he accept this ministry and this challenge, as opposed to this or the other. In other words, what keeps you here? And what are some of the things that are giving you a little bit of heartburn right now in terms of, what are the burdens that you're feeling? How would you want people to pray for you right now? And I would just keep asking these questions. Usually I take a tape recorder with me, so I'm hearing his responses, and we're just having this very, very informal chat, just he and I. Once a month, we would have this chat. And then I'd go back and I'd write a letter. And I'd try to, it was a letter on his behalf, because a lot of times the presidents of organizations don't have the time to, sit down and write letters. And so I'd write a letter. And as the more I got to know him, the more I began to relate to him, the more I realized, what was comfortable to him in terms of approach and appearance of letters. He didn't like sentence fragments, and sometimes creative writers tend to take a little license with some of the rules of English or whatever. And so I had to write in a way that was compatible with his desire, because this was a letter that was essentially signed by him. But essentially, the letter would be 2 pages in length. It would be personalized, Dear Jerry and Sue. It would acknowledge the relationship that they had, or that we had with that individual as a member of the president's club or whatever. And then, let me share with you. And he would usually anecdotally tell the story of some student in the school, or maybe a graduate or an alumnus. And, let me share with you some of the concerns that, we're facing right now at the school. And they weren't necessarily financial concerns, but, here we have, a group of our seniors that are getting ready to go out in ministry. Some of our seniors don't even know where they're going, and some of them are still struggling in terms of their calling and what that calling represents. Is it pastoral ministry? Is it teaching ministry and so forth? And so pray that the Lord would give us wisdom in recognizing, where these people are, so that we can direct them in ministry so that they can have a fruitful life of so forth and so on. Okay, 6 months later, they would get another personal call from the president. Now, we were trying to track all the information that we're gathering from these people in their database record. See, there's a database entry for Jerry and Sue Twombly. And if Jerry and Sue Twombly, there's a section in our database that if Jerry and Sue Twombly in a communication to the president, indicated certain things that were unique to them that would help us in really building that relationship, we preserve that information. And so, in this call, the president would print out the database record or the relevant aspects of the database record that pertain to, Jerry and Sue. And so when he calls, this is another just a 6 month, hey, was thinking about you, wanted just to take time to express, again, thanks for your involvement in what it is that we're doing here at Grace. And then a little bit of a report in terms of, let me just give you an update of some of the neat things that are happening right now, just to let you know what's going on. Perhaps a piece of a counsel that was being sought We're taking a kind of an informal survey of all of our President's Club members as it relates to four things that we would like to determine, you know, whether or not this is something that is of a, you know, real concern to them or whatever. But there was something that we were seeking in terms from them in ways of information that would help us to more effectively serve them and the group of which they were a part. And then there was just some share, you know, some mutual exchange of information. And like, how are Chris and Chad doing? Well, Chris and Chad happen to be my sons, and the president happens to know that. And so he asks how they're doing. He's making notes, and all that information goes into the database on data that we're tracking in relationship to these individuals. And then is there something we can pray for you for? And many times he might even pray with them over the phone, you know, and just thank the Lord for their involvement and so forth. But this was the next call, okay. Then in 9 months, they received another kind of a personal insider, another letter that was personalized for that particular month for the group of people that were cycled to get that letter that month. And then in the 12th month, basically it was an invitation to re-enroll in the program. Now, we started at Grace College and Seminary back in the mid-80s. With 17 people. When I took my position as Vice President for Advancement at Grace College and Seminary in 1982 or 3, there were 17 members of the President's Club, okay? 17 people who had committed contributions of $1,000 or more to support the school by becoming a member of this group of people that we basically recognize, here's a group of people that could give at this level, all right? They have the potential of giving at this level. Not everybody could give at this level. The people that could give at lesser levels were provided another opportunity to be able to be a part. And we did similar type things with them. There were other people that could give more than this, and they were invited to participate at another level of giving or another level of involvement in the organization. And so it wasn't, but this group of people, there were 17 of them. When I left 4 years later, we had 550 of them. Now, if you're kind of doing the math on that, that's the difference between $17,000 and $550,000 annually. And if you're looking at it from strictly a developmental standpoint, that was the easiest $550,000 that I'd ever raise, you know, as soon as that letter went out, because we had about a 97%. You know, retention rate, that 97% of the people that were participating in that program, you know, retained or continued their involvement in that program, you know, year after year after year after year. Now, the point is, I don't think that would have happened to the extent that it happened had it not been for this, which was, you know, kind of, in other words, if we received the gift and they got the plaque and that was it, you know, then I think we probably would have had, you know, maybe a 30 to 40% retention rate. But the fact is that the president said, these are important people. These are people that are really going to enable us to accomplish what it is that we've committed ourselves to do. And successfully, we have, or collectively, we have greater potential of being able to impact, you know, this ministry and what it is this ministry is committed to do, you know, together than we can alone. And while the president probably wouldn't have done this, the president could clearly assume that after the gift, you know, there are two ways, you know, this relationship could have moved. We could have moved independently. The school continues to function. You know, we intersect periodically, usually once a year, you know, when we're asking them for money. And so it could go that way. That's the way it is a lot of marriage relationships go after marriage, isn't it? You know, she goes here, he goes here. Oh, and periodically we get together, but it looks more like this, you know. You know, I love the analogy of Ecclesiastes. You know, a three-corded, you know, the rope or whatever is stronger. And it seems to me that you know what you really want to see happen in relationships is this kind of a thing, as opposed to this kind of a drawing. That basically there are relational intersections, you know, where we're, you know, we're constantly striving to grow deeper in relationship, and the only practical way of being able to do that successfully is to be able to track it in a database. Now, you know, there's a sense in which development is very personal, and there's also a sense in which it's very impersonal. I mean, you know, you sit down here and you work in this database. Now, let me give you a suggestion. If I were, I know some of the ministries that are represented here because we've chatted throughout the week. If I'm, you know, Tim McConnell, for instance, who's seeking to develop a developmental infrastructure for the Eurasian Missionary College in Kazan, Tartarstan, that's his job, and he's trying to get this thing started. Well, you know, database almost, you know, that sounds almost intimidating, you know, database. I mean, some of you hear that and you think, oh boy, you know, $15,000 to buy Razor's Edge or you know, $2,500 to do this, that, or the other thing. And so, but you know what I would do if I were Tim? And we're beginning a development program, we're just trying to get it started. What I would do is I'd probably buy a very inexpensive off-the-shelf program. And there's some that are pre-programmed. There's one that I really, really like. It's called ACT, A-C-T, and it has various editions, you know, ACT 2000, 2001, 2002. I don't know what the most recent edition of ACT, but it's actually a software program that was designed for people that do sales, but it absolutely is perfect in doing a lot of the things that you need to do. And it's one that you just use. In other words, you may have 50 people on that list of 50 people with whom you're seeking to build a relationship with, but you use that database to track all the things that are happening in that relationship. But the point that I want to make as we kind of look through this particular example is that there was a plan, okay? There was a plan. We recognize that this is a group of people that we need engaged in the support of our ministry. Most of you would say, yeah, we need people that can, you know, support us at varying levels. It may be in terms of what it is they can contribute financially. It may be in terms of what it is they can contribute, you know, through their involvement. You know, and the realities are, it's recognizing the groups of people with whom we need to build a relationship, what it is we feel those groups can contribute to the whole of what it is we've committed ourselves to, and then creating a plan that they could basically plug into. And then what happened here, what made that program work was not the fact that we had a president's club. What made that program work is this. And not the fact that these events happened, but every single thing on that list was planned to really develop a deepening relationship between those individuals and the organization or the institution. Is that making any sense at all? Because, you know, I think we can talk about all of these things and you think, well, okay, I think I'm kind of following. Now, let's kind of leave this a little bit, and I'm going to draw a diagram that I've been drawing all week. But what I'm trying to do in the post forum here is to say, okay, you've got a little bit of the background to become involved in what I hope can be a very, very meaningful discussion. Now, this drawing, most of you have seen all week. These are the four things that are essential to having a successful development program, you know, for your ministry. These four things need to be in place. Okay? The first one is mission. It's kind of foundational to this. I mean, when you look at this triangle, it's stable because of the foundation, the base. The mission, what it is we've committed ourselves to, is literally the engine. It drives everything that we do. Everything. You know, how we relate to donors, how we relate to the community, how we relate to our target audience, be it students or whatever, everything that we do, our curriculum, our co-curricular programs, everything that we do is driven by mission. In the context of development, I call mission the essence of rationality. Now, for those of you that have been with me all week, that makes an awful lot of sense, that phrase, the essence of rationality. Because what I have told you from the very beginning of our time together is that development, defined, represents the things that we do to move people into a rational relationship with us. In other words, the whole focus of the developmental function, you know, in your ministry, and you're doing it, I mean, the realities are we're all doing development. You're doing development for your ministry. You just don't know you're doing development for your ministry. If you say, if you don't have a development program, we say, we don't have a development, you know, you're doing it. I mean, we're all doing it. But from my perspective, the focus of development is to build relationships and to build them of a certain quality. In other words, people are supporting us. And in our first session, and bear with me because it's repetition, but it's still important for you to remember, there are three reasons why people will sustain their involvement with your organization. Three very, very important reasons. And you constantly need to remind yourself of these three reasons. The three reasons why people will continue to support you are, number one, they know your mission. They know it. Okay, this is what this mission, this is what this organization is committed to doing. This is their mission. All right, they know your mission. Number two, you know, we want to continue to have them, because that's really success. It's not just gaining them, it's sustaining their involvement. And now, you know, what we're assembling, think of it this way, what we're assembling is a team. I don't know what it, when I was growing up, and maybe that's a good place to make a pause, and I've never given this illustration, I don't think ever, in the context of a seminar. But I have these wonderful little memories as a kid. You know, growing up in this little neighborhood. Now, when our kid, you know, in America, when I was growing up, every kid played baseball. I mean, we had bicycles, and we put our baseball glove on the handlebar, you know, and we're kind of running around neighborhoods looking for a baseball game, you know, looking for some place that we could play baseball. And so, you know, eventually we'd, you know, see a bunch of kids over in a field over in the, you know, somebody's yard, and so we'd all get together and we'd rip off our baseball gloves and we'd go out and we'd pick up teams, all right? And so, you know, we're, you know, who's going to be on the team? And we had these little rules, you know, we'd throw a baseball bat out and somebody, we'd put our hands up until whoever got to the peak of the baseball bat. Those of you that Americans can really relate to this. Those of you that are not are saying, well, we do it in cricket, you know, in Australia. But the point is that, you know, being selected, I mean, if you can relate in any way to that illustration, you know how... I always liked it when saying, well, I'm going to pick Jerry to be on my team. And there was I can still almost kind of feel, you know, what the flood of acceptance and appreciation that came, you know, as a part of that selective process, that somebody realized that I could contribute something to what it is they felt we needed to do in order to be able to, you know, be successful. Well, that's what we're doing in development, is we're really assembling a team, aren't we? We're trying to figure out, well, who do we need on this team in order to take us to where it is we need to go? And there are all kinds of members of the team. Well, these team members need to know, first of all, what it is that we're all about, what the purpose, what it is that the objective to which we've committed ourselves. And they have to be, for all practical purposes, kind of sold on the mission, right? That this is really a relevant mission. This is pretty important. We really want to accomplish this. But the third reason... why they will continue their involvement in what it is that you're doing. You know, they'll stay on the team. The third reason is that they have confidence in your ability to be able to do it. Okay? That they know this mission, they believe in this mission, but they have a level of confidence that you are inspiring them to, in a variety of ways, to understand that this mission is being accomplished, that we are making meaningful progress. So mission is very, very important. Then you have up here vision. And vision equals mission accomplished. Now I'm going to take this a little bit further here today than what we took it during the week, but there is a target. You know, yes, sir. The second one is to believe in the mission. In other words, you know, a lot of missions, you know, I'm not all that concerned about. You know, somebody says, well, our mission is to raise up Christian hockey players in Switzerland. Well, hey, listen, I'm not suggesting that that's not a worthy mission for some organization. But, you know, it doesn't really appeal to me. It doesn't resonate with where my heart is. So not everybody's going to, you know, agree with your mission or be able to endorse it in the same sense that others might. Okay? So they need to believe in your mission, and then they have to be convinced. See, that's the key. If they lack the confidence, and confidence is something that, you know, the president, you know, essentially was building with these phone calls and with his letters. You know, when we profile the letter, when we profile the perfect phone call, you know, one of the things that are kind of behind all of these things is kind of instilling the sense of confidence that we are, you know, our institution is making a difference, and they are an integral part of our ability to be able to do that. And that's why we have 97%, you know, retention. Now, this is, you know, I'll put a target up here. I think most of us can relate to a target, okay? And this is the target audience. In other words, in order for us to accomplish our mission, there are people involved. In a student ministry, it's students. Okay? So if you're a college, you know, it's students. If you're a retreat center, it's the people that come to the retreat center. If you're a ministry like exists there in Cambridge, it's the people that come to visit the museum. And I'm not sure that I've not been to Cambridge. I've been to Cambridge, but I've not been to your ministry, so I need to come so that I can be exposed and more intelligently speak about it. In the case of Tim, you know, the focus is actually, it's a twofold focus, obviously. It's the students, you know, that are being trained to plant churches so that people in, you know, Islamic countries around the earth, especially within the 1040 window, can be presented the claims of Christ in ways that are going to hopefully be appealing and that they can respond to. So there is a target, okay, and it's people. Now we know that number one, these people will flourish in an environment, in a relational environment. That's a basic principle of development, that people, you know, this target group of people to which we're committed to ministering to, you know, are going to flourish in a relational environment. I think we all agree with that. I mean, think about your life. You know, think about decisions you've made in your life. Think about your journey, this journey of walking in faith and trusting God and whatever it was that, you know, all the things that have happened, all the little, you know, kind of points, you know, along the way that have kind of resulted in our being here. And there's usually a face or two behind them, aren't there? You know, people, you know, who came into your life and who've ministered to you. So this is one thing we need to know, is that people will flourish in a relational environment. Now, success in terms of accomplishing what our vision is going to occur as people are transformed. And the people, you know, that are transformed are going to be students, okay? They're going to be, and these students are going to represent, you know, theoretically different groups. Let's say that in Philip's ministry, as he's contemplating maybe moving into a campus-type ministry, well, the students that come to the campus chapter meeting, you know, are going to be, there's going to be Christians, there's going to be non-Christians, and even, you could kind of even break it down further than this. I mean, you've got, you know, biology majors, you've got, you know, I mean, the realities are, there are groups of people, And from a strategic standpoint, and this is my point here, that from a strategic standpoint, you know, plan around groups. Plan around groups. In other words, if you have a group of, you know, science students, then, you know, create a plan as it relates to the fulfillment of your mission that's kind of oriented towards that group. You know, if we were totally successful in ministering to the science students in the ways that we feel God would have us to do that, then, you know, what would we want them to look like? Well, we'd want them to know the Lord. We'd want them to be, to the extent that our ministry could contribute to this, we'd want them to be sensitive to the ways in which they could take the application of their scientific discipline into the field in which it's going to be exploited in a way that would bring, you know, honor to the Lord. And I'm not sure that I've said that real correctly, but the point is that we need to have a plan for the group, and then our agenda or our curriculum and our co-curricular activities, all those things that we talked about in terms of the planning model, you know, need to make sure that we are that it is contributing to the fulfillment of that plan, that we have a database on each one of those individuals that practically shows us the progress that we're making, recognizing that there's differences. Not everybody's in the same relationship to the plan as the person sitting next to them, that kind of a scenario. And so everything that we did with essentially the President's Club is being reduplicated with science students that we are committed to reaching on the college campus at XYZ University in Sydney. In other words, what happens so often in ministry is that we become so general in our approach that we're having minimal impact. In America, I'm sure you may call them different things, but we call them flyways. You know, there are a lot of people that are duck hunters. You know, they just hunt for duck. And there are flyways. You know, they're like roots in the sky where these ducks fly. You know, and I happen to live in a flyway. You know, and there are a lot of geese that fly over my house, and we're right on the root of a major water wetland area. And so we've got these geese that are, you know, flying into this wetland area. Now, there are two ways that I could probably hunt for geese. You know, one is I could lay on my back in my front yard with a 12-gauge shotgun, and I could just sit there and shoot, you know, boom, 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 boom. And I could do that for days and days and days, and maybe eventually, maybe a duck would fly over while I'm shooting, and I might get one. And but the realities are, you would say, well, that would be a total waste of time. And, you know, what you need to do, Jerry, is you need to know when the geese are going to be flying over. You probably could be in a better place in order to be able to maximize what it is that you really want to accomplish. And so you might give me a plan that essentially is going to make me a better goose hunter, okay? Well, that's exactly what I'm saying here. In other words, you know, we're doing ministry, and oftentimes we're doing ministry well. And occasionally, God gives us a little bit of fruit, and we're kind of grateful for it, and we're thankful for it. But are there things that we could do to maximize fruitfulness? And I think, yes, there is. And one is, you know, focusing our attention more particularly upon the groups of people that are being impacted by our organization, making sure that we have a plan to address those, that we're tracking that plan through database development or database management, and that we're monitoring that plan, we're constantly evaluating it to make it a better plan, and hopefully by God's grace, He's going to use that to accomplish what it is that He wants to accomplish in the lives of people. And to the extent that that happens, then yes, ministry now is really taking place. And to the extent that ministry is taking place successfully, what do? From a developmental standpoint, we start sharing that, don't we? You know, when the president calls, let me tell you what happened in the life of Sergio this week. You know, Sergio, we've been praying for several months because we realized that Sergio is a little bit resistant about going back to his area of the world. And you know, he didn't know what it is he wanted to do. And so we've been praying as a group. You know, our faculty has been praying for Sergio. Sergio is a part of a small group. They've been praying for Sergio. Let me tell you what happened in Sergio's life this week. And so you start telling the story. Now, what does that do in the minds of your people? It kind of builds the confidence, you know, that you know, this is an organization that is committed to something and results are taking place, and everybody wants to be a part of a boat or a train that's going somewhere. But if they don't believe or they don't have the confidence that the train that you're asking them to get on is going someplace, they will eventually jump off at the next stop. Okay? So the point is, we want them on the train because we need them on the train in order to get the train to where it is we want to go. But what's going to keep them on the train, you know, is going to be their confidence that this train is going to where it is they want to go. So not only did the president tell them the story of Sergio, okay, he reminds them that it's because of you and 419 people like you, as well as the other 2,456 donors that we have to our organization, it's because of you that this is happening. And so just re-cementing, you know, the role that they play, that their investment in the school is not just, people could care less, donors could care less about your buildings. So when we raise money for buildings, we're missing the point. That's not to say that you don't need buildings in order to do what it is that you need to do. But people could care less about buildings. Donors don't care about buildings. I don't care about a building. I may send you money that you might use to build a building, but what I'm concerned about is how that building is being used to enable you to accomplish what it is you've committed yourself to do. Because if you're just building buildings for building's sake, then I don't really want to, and I don't care to be involved in that process. So when we lead, and this is an important point as you're talking to people, when you lead with your need, it's almost totally counterproductive, depending upon if the need is for finances to build a building. Lead with your vision, not with your need. Lead with your vision, and then bring the need, if in fact the need is for a building or for the establishment of a new program that's going to require money, or the, you know, bringing in faculty that's going to enable us to accomplish the mission, to the extent that we need those, then put it into the context of the vision. But it doesn't stand alone, because your need for buildings, your need for programs, your need for people is not independent of what it is that you've committed yourself to do. And so knowing what the target is, knowing who the groups are, knowing what their needs are in order to transform them in the context of what it is transformation looks like as it relates to the fulfillment of your mission. You know, knowing that, having a plan in place, monitoring the plan, tracking the results, reporting the results to your constituents. You know, that's the development side of it. The mission side of it is knowing who the people are, knowing what their needs are, knowing what it is that you're doing to accomplish it. What that yields is what? Transform people. And transform people, what do they impact? They're used of God to transform the groups of which they're a part, the communities of which they're a part. Transform communities, what does that represent? Transform culture. The point that I'm making is that the whole purpose of ministry is transformation. And to the extent that we lose that focus, then we lose the enthusiastic involvement, you know, of people that come alongside to support us. Now, all right, now, in order to, you know, put perspective on all of this, you know, to make this diagram really add meaning, what we need is we need this side of the triangle, okay? And it's see it as a series of steps. We're going from here. This represents where we are. In other words, you need to objectively assess as an organization where you are. Jim Collins' book, Good to Great, which, by the way, is a pretty interesting book, and we've talked a little bit about it in the context of the network this week. It's a very interesting book. It talks about 11 different companies, you know, in the United States over a 15-year period of time. It showed unusual growth and development, despite the fact that the economy wasn't developing at the same degree that they were increasing, and so forth. Basically, the book is tracking what it is that happened in those organizations and what made them great organizations from where it is that they were. Well, one of the steps in the process of assessing good to great, Jim Collins said, every one of these organizations had to face what he called the grim realities. And the grim realities were, this is where we are. This is where we want to go, and this is where we are. And until you face the grim realities of where your organization is in relationship to where you need to be, until you face the grim realities and specifically know what they are, you can't essentially, you know, build the case that you need to build in terms of strategic planning to take you from where it is you are to where it is you need to be. From a developmental standpoint, grim realities are seen in two broad categories. One is essentially a resource category or a developmental category. And then you can measure yourself in terms of impact. In other words, how significant or how effective your organization is accomplishing the spiritual impact in the lives of people. But you need to get the grim realities, you know, how well you're doing in each category. Grim realities in terms of resource development is basically, and I'm only going to give five, there are six actually, what I call leading developmental indicators, LDIs. But the grim realities are, you know, the size of your database. Is your database big enough to accomplish what it is that you need to accomplish? Does it have enough names on it of the right kind of people in the right categories? And are you building relationships with those people in a way consistent with your need and bringing them on board to share with you and what it is that God's called you to do at the level that you'll need to in order to accomplish the objectives to which you've committed yourself to in a time-effective way? All right? So database is important. The number of donors that you have on an annual basis. And if you find donors a little bit, you know, crass, you know, because it seems like the only thing that we need is donors, you know, think of it in terms of partners. I mean, do we have enough partners in a variety of ways, you know, in the areas where we need them in order to be able to accomplish what we've committed ourselves to? But you need to know that. The average amount of dollars that you're raising on an annual basis, and then the next two have to do with sizes of contributions. And it probably is worth mentioning, just for the sake of review for many of you, and for those of you hearing it for the first time, it's certainly worth mentioning. But you need to know how many people that are giving at different levels, but there are two levels that are very, very important for you to know, and that's what I call major donors, and then there's another level called mega donors. Now, we're talking about the developmental resources wherein we have to get a picture of the grim realities. Okay, a major donor in my little world, okay, is people who give $1,000. This is U.S. dollars, and this is a U.S. economy figure, so and we could get into the cultural ramifications of this, and I certainly don't mind the discussion, but I suspect that time is going to prohibit it from being too meaningful. But you need major donors, people that are giving at a larger level, and you need mega donors, people that are giving at a much, you know, say $10,000 or more a year. So you need people at every one of those levels. There's a certain pragmatic part of our business that, you know, I become a bit frustrated with, but nonetheless I've come to realize that it's true. You know, the 80-20 rule, you know, 80% of the money is going to come from 20% of the people. You know, that's, you know, you might not like it, but that's reality. 80% of the work that's done in your organization is going to be done by 20% of the people. 80% of everything, you know, seems to be in that, follow that model, which has proven itself to be consistently true in application after application. So it's knowing, you know, first of all, where you are in relationship to these top five. This one is more of an algebraic formula, which has probably not too much relevance to this discussion. But you need to know where you are currently as it relates to these leading developmental indicators, and you need to know where it is you should be if you're going to accomplish the things that you've committed yourself to accomplish on an annual basis in fulfilling and enabling your organization to fulfill its ultimate goals. In other words, this side of the triangle represents the strategic plan. And the strategic plan, again, you know, states in quantifiable terms the things that need to happen this year, next year, the years thereafter, to get us from where it is we are to where it is by God's grace we sense He's calling us to go. And hear this, and this is again repetitive in many instances, but hear this, that a plan that lacks quantification, you know, is a good idea. We can kind of hope that it will happen, but it's just a good idea. Now, so we need to understand the grim realities. We need to know where it is we want to go. We need to have some kind of an idea of what it's going to require of us in order to be able to accomplish the quantifiable objectives in terms of finances, dollars, and people and so forth. And we need to be implementing and monitoring that plan on a regular basis. Now, I was thinking about how to state all of that practically in ways that might be helpful for you to kind of think through it. I wrote these this morning, and they may lack a little bit of continuity, but hopefully I think it might take us somewhere the way we answer these questions. Let's talk about you know, the fact that we might be building a house for our family. That's something that most of us can relate to. You know, we all live someplace and so forth. And so if you had the ideal house for your family, you know, what would it have? And so let's just talk about what does a house need to have in it in order to be able to be an adequate house for our family. What are some of the things that you're going to need? What's that? Jacuzzi? Oh, then that would be nice. It probably wouldn't go all high on the list, but maybe it would, you know. And I'm not suggesting, you know, that's kind of an interesting discussion. We probably ought to add that to some of the things that we're going to be talking about. And then you're going to say, well, what does jacuzzis have to do with this? And I think I can show you the relevance of the process that we're going through to this process that you need to be involved in your organization. But you're going to need, what, bedrooms, right? I mean, if you've got 10 kids, then you're going to need more than two bedrooms. You might need three or four bedrooms, depending upon, or maybe five bedrooms, depending upon the sex of the kids and the age of the kids and so forth. And so the number of bedrooms that you would need, even in a scenario like that, is going to be predicated on the age of children, the sex of the kids. And, you know, you may say, well, we want them to share rooms together because in that environment... Now, see, here's how building a house, you know, with the thought that goes behind or should go behind building a house, that, you know, in our philosophy of raising children, we want them to live together, to work and function together. And one of the ways that we envision that happening, most people don't think through this when they're buying a house, by the way, but that we want them to live together in a restricted space, you know, where they have to share something and with one of their family members, and they've got to learn to live this way comfortably. And so, you know, we may have 10 kids, but we've got four bedrooms, and this is what it is. You know, we've got three in one room and six in another, that type of situation. I'm not suggesting that would be ideal. Okay, what are some of the other things that you would need? Are we all tired? This is, you know, okay, we have been here too long. What's that? All right, you need a kitchen, and you need an eating place, wouldn't you? An eating area. How big should that eating area be? Pardon me? If you want to all eat together there, then it's going to have to be a certain size. And the prominence that we give a room, you know, in terms of size or whatever, is going to be predicated on the role that we're seeing that room fulfill in terms of the way that we live our life. In other words, a lot of people will have you know, an emphasis on a family room. That would be common in our country anyway, where, you know, or we have in our house, you know, a large kitchen and a large dining area, and we have a design in our house that allows for the flow of people. So we could have 100 people in our house, and actually, you know, the way that the house is designed, it kind of accommodates that, because that's the kind of lifestyle that we live in, bringing people, you know, from around the world and people from around our community and into our home. So we've designed, or we've had a house, we chose a house that kind of met the lifestyle that we live and what it is that we do. So the size of your kitchen, the size of the eating space, the size of the rooms, all those things are really pretty important. Now, if you're getting ready to build a house, is there a logical progression in how that happens? I mean, you don't build bedrooms first, do you? What's the first thing you do in building a house? Pardon me? Okay. You find a location for it, and you want to make sure that the location, you know, the building site is capable and comparable or competent, and I'm not getting the right word out. If I suppose I could work on it for half an hour, and I might get it out, but we'll just move on. There is a, you know, when building a house, what do? You find a lot, and then you determine where on the lot you want the house, and then you take into consideration the availability of utilities as it relates to that house, and then you dig a foundation, and then you pour a footer, and then you do it in that sequence. There's a sense in which there's sequence in building a house. Well, just like there's sequence in building a house, there's sequence in building a developmental house that's going to support, practically speaking, what it is we've committed ourselves to do here. And what that house looks like is going to be predicated on what it is that we want to accomplish in the house. I mean, how many bedrooms do we need, theoretically? How big does the dining room need to be, theoretically? You know, typically, you know, we look to the house as the essence of what it is that we have to do. We have got to build a house. And we start building a house, or we start building a church before we really have grappled with these issues. And so does the church, the most perfect church that's going to accomplish these results, does it have to have a build? Does it need to be a building, or it can be a cell church? I was just talking with somebody from Belarus the other day, or somebody just been to Belarus, and they said there's a real movement of the Spirit of God, and there's hardly, you know, any churches, you know, and while the buildings, you know, I guess exist, I haven't been to Belarus, so I can't really speak intelligently about what's there. But what was really impressive to the person that was at Belarus is that the work of God was happening, and it was happening dynamically in the lives of people who were meeting together in homes and intimate situations. They were growing, they had a plan, things were happening, and this, the physical appearance of what it is that existed there, you know, didn't match up with what typically we think is essential if we're going to have an effective church ministry. You know, to have an effective church ministry, what do we have to have? We have to have a building. What's that building going to look like? Well, it's got to be at least $150 or $200 a square meter or whatever in order to be able to make it look right. You know, it's going to have stained glass windows and a chapel and a, you know, whatever, and a narthex, and it's going to be huge, and it's going to be impressive, and everybody's going to look at it and be drawn to God. And we see, you know, as we walk and ride and drive through Europe, we see those buildings everywhere. And we see a level of spiritual destitution, you know, in that same environment, because those buildings aren't producing saints. Now, could they be facilitating models? And, you know, you go to, I understand that your ministry in Salisbury, I can't wait to go and visit, but that's a place where really God can work. And so the facility is not incidental to what it is that you do, but because it was designed that way. But that same facility might have existed for hundreds of years before and not had any kind of spiritual impact, because, you know, the facility is not the answer. You know, what it is that happens in that facility and to the degree that it's planned is very, very important. We need to take a break. It's 11. And some people are leaving now. Who are the folks that are leaving right now? Okay, we'll finish this up. I've got to stop and pick up one more thing before I leave Chopron. So I think I've got my wife covered here. I've got some porcelain from Chopron, which I think she'll be quite happy with, and so trying to cover the kids and the grandkids. I've got Kinder eggs. Yeah, And here they're called, they're not Kinder eggs in the way that you get them in Germany. They're Kinder Care or something like that, but there's a different kind of, and actually what's inside's a little bit different, you know. So they're designed a little bit differently. I've discovered that as you travel throughout Europe. Oh, I'm an expert on Kinder eggs. The kids love them. That's the only thing they expect from, you know, Grandpa when he comes home is, you know, hey, they call me Bump. I'm Bumpa, you know, say, hey, Bump, open up the suitcase here. Where's the Kinder eggs, you know? They're expecting them. Okay, we're going to take, basically what I'd like to do is just kind of finish this whole thing up. And we've taken a little bit of a different tact in describing this model today. And hopefully it's kind of building upon what it is that we've done, but hopefully adding a dimension to it that makes it a little bit more personal and intimate and feeling a little bit nicer than some of the, you know, just restating facts that we have a tendency to do in the broader sessions. You know, getting a understanding the grim realities, knowing what it is that we need to go, defining these steps in quantifiable terms. There's one final part of this model that you're all familiar with now, those of you that have been with me at least, and for any length of time, and that's this side here, which is again another series of steps, which interestingly enough, should correspond exactly with these steps. And I call this the development plan. And the development plan, essentially, you know, think of the development plan as the plan that you have in place to deploy resources at the time you need those resources to accomplish these objectives to which you've committed yourself to over here. There's a form of management in America. I should say America. You know, Americans are horribly arrogant, forgive me. There is a universal plan that we happen to use. It was actually, I think, developed by the Japanese, actually. It's called just-in-time management, and I think, you know, JET management principles are pretty well known around the world, especially in manufacturing. If car is being manufactured, you know, it goes through an assembly line, and there comes a point in the assembly line where it needs a transmission, and so, you know, the people that are putting in the transmissions turn around. There's the transmission. They take it into the onto the assembly line. They assemble it. They put it into the car, and it goes on to the next station. Well, that you know, what's really interesting about that, in terms of a management standpoint, is that transmission may have arrived, 30 minutes ago. In other words, organizations don't keep inventories now. They just kind of have the delivery truck come up, unload the transmission. It goes from the truck to the unloading point, the loading dock, right exactly to the place that needs to be when it needs to be there. And it's called just-in-time management. Well, you know, think of development as basically the supply chain. In other words, what do you need from a resource standpoint to accomplish these, you know, these five objectives or these six objectives? What do you need? And when do you need it? And what is your plan to get it when you need it and deliver it to where it needs to be in order for these things to be done? So these things, you know, don't operate apart from one another. They're intricately and intimately involved. And so they need to be defined in terms of, again, the same way quantifiably. In other words, in order for us to be able to accomplish these objectives that we've listed over here as being absolutely critical to our ability to accomplish this, then we're going to need a group of, you know, 100 volunteers that are equipped and who have the gifts and the abilities needed in order for us to be able to accomplish these initiatives. We're going to need, you know, $100,000. We're going to need to allocate a certain block of time, you know, and have that scheduled into our overall ministry plan in order to be able to accomplish these objectives. In other words, this needs to be planned too. And so while we, you know, this is important, and 88% of all ministries in the world, Christian ministries, don't have a strategic plan, which is kind of catastrophic on its own, is it not? You know, here we have this incredible vision to, you know, make a difference in the world, and 88% of the organizations who are committed to making a difference, to transform the culture, in the ways that only Christianity and Christ and salt and light can transform it, they don't have a plan to do it. And so, you know, is there any reason why we're not, you know, we've been so, you know, I think the attacks of the enemy are, you know, more divide and conquer than, you know, frontal attack. In other words, if we can get our focus on the wrong places, we can get our focus on buildings, we get our focus on something else rather than what it is that God's called us to do, then we'll probably be ineffective in and of ourselves, you know, without, you know, him having to do or the enemy having to do something more than, you know, dramatic. So, in defining these, we spent some time talking about defining those, you know, how many donors do you need? We're not going to go into those formulas. Those are a little bit probably more complex and less interesting, but nonetheless very, very important. And if you need those formulas, we can make sure that you have them available to you. In other words, if you needed to raise X number of dollars, you know, I could tell you the number in an ideal developmental world. I could tell you the number of core donors that you would need, donors that were giving at $1,000 or less. I could tell you the number of major donors that you should have, the type, the size, the number of mega donors that you would need, and the size of your database should be. I can help you with that, but it does need to be planned. In other words, it's not, you know, the process of building ministry isn't necessarily a mystery. It's just a matter of putting building blocks together in the right place and keeping your focus where it needs to be, which I think is ultimately, obviously, on the Lord, because he really is our source. But I do believe that he does bless, you know, the responsible stewardship or the exercise of stewardship that we need to be engaged in accomplishing the objectives to which we've committed ourselves to. So that's the model. Let's see if there are some other summary statements that I'd like to make, and then we can just spend the rest of our time just kind of interacting with that if you'd like. There are some other notes that I made. There are principles that drive the developmental process or models that drive the developmental process. What I've spent my time this week talking about is those models. There are five of them, and this is one of them, and there are four others. The process of development, you know, you identify people with whom you're building a relationship and qualify them and cultivate them. Developmental procedure, you know, bringing people to the front porch. The planning model that we kind of outlined in a real abbreviated way. An organizational model, how you get it done. So there are the models. There are rules, some underlying rules that kind of drive the effectiveness of the model. I'm trying to get this all graphically done in my head, you know, so that it makes a lot of sense. And I'm not really have been that successful, but I told Greg Pritchard this morning at breakfast, I said, you know, if you give me about two more years working Chopron, I think I'm going to have, you know, the presentation of this figured out in the multicultural climate that you throw me into here, which I'm so grateful for. And so, and actually a lot of my study this year, I think, in terms of trying to develop ideas is going to center around Chopron 2005. In other words, I'm going to start on the way home putting together material, and hopefully by next June I'm going to have you know, some stuff done that will be hopefully even better than this is. Hopefully this is good, but we can do a better job. So there are rules that underline the effective implementation of the principles, some core rules of development. We spent some time talking about those. And those tapes, by the way, I mean the videos of the session, all the network session was videotaped. And so if you haven't been here or if you weren't here, then you can pick up those videotapes, and I think you'll find them to be helpful. And then, you know, dysfunctional organizations. I just made a note to myself of dysfunctional organizations. I've been rather intrigued that I haven't developed this idea at all. But yesterday, or on the first day we were together, and I'm just going to kind of share with you something I'm thinking about, which we talked about, you know, we talked about leadership, and I drew a circle of leadership, and I said that there are certain aspects of leadership that over which we have no control. We have a propensity. I mean, all of us have a propensity, various propensities to lead. I mean, some people just like to lead. They kind of walk into a situation and boom, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you weren't there 10 minutes and you were just elected chairman of the board, you know. And or something similar to that. My son had that experience not long ago. He became real interested in what we were doing with Habitat for Humanity, and there happens to be a Habitat for Humanity affiliate, you know, in his town. Now, he's kind of a aggressive guy, and, you know, real deeply loves the Lord. He's kind of a, you know, a personable person, and so he asked if they were ever having a board meeting, and so they said, yeah, well, in fact, we're having one here tonight, and so they invited him to the board meeting, and he did walk out at the end of the board meeting as the chairman of the board. So, I mean, I guess it does happen, you know, but probably not, and in that organization, it probably happens more often than not, actually, but anyway, there are individuals that have various propensities to lead. Some people, you know, really gravitate to leadership. Other people kind of step back, but they're comfortable in leadership. And there are other people that just kind of don't want to be leaders, but they certainly want to be a part of an organization. Well, this week, we did a little bit of a study, and we call those different categories. You have mobilizers. You have leaders that are mobilizers. You know, they just mobilize other people. They just can get them excited. They're visionaries. They're inspirational. They're people that, you know, essentially are wonderfully used to capture the enthusiasm and the innate desires of people and kind of put them into they mobilize. Then you have a group that's called organizers, and those are the people, if you come upon a crisis situation, you know, where, you know, there's an accident and all of a sudden there are victims laying all over the ground, you know, and they all need help. And the organizer, you know, recognizes that there's some people that are, you know, in really bad shape. It's kind of a triage type situation. These people need the most immediate attention. People need to be transported immediately to the hospital. These people are bleeding. We just need to stop the bleeding, but their life, you know, situation. And so they're organizing. And then there's the stabilizers. And the stabilizers are, you know, kind of carrying out the blankets, making sure people are comfortable, putting pillows under their head, you know, serving. And so you have mobilizers, you have organizers, and you have stabilizers. And essentially, those are more innate capabilities. I mean, you don't, you know, some people are just kind of just naturally mobilizers and so forth. And while we all probably have tendencies in all three areas, we tend to gravitate to some. So that's a component of leadership. And those are the things over which, you know, our capacity, let's say, our capacity to lead. And then you have individual giftedness. That's another component of leadership, giftedness. Some of you are gifted. I mean, we're all gifted, I think, in wonderful ways by the Spirit of God. And especially for ministry, we have spiritual gifts. And, you know, those gifts can be used to further the cause of the kingdom of God in a variety of ways. And so we have giftedness. And this top part of the leadership circle, if we're using that as a leadership model, these are things over which we have no control. I didn't, you know, choose the gift that God gave me. I recognize that He's gifted me in some unique and different ways. And I've sought to ask myself the question how I can use that giftedness to further His kingdom in the ways that would be compatible to His desire. But there are two other components that I think are unique that make up this person that we call a leader or make up all of us as far as that's concerned. One has to do with character issues. And I think character, if you're looking at a biblical definition of character, I think character is the result of understanding. I'm intrigued by the words in the scriptures, knowledge, wisdom, and understanding, that we know things. And a lot of people know about character. They know, you know, things, you know, principles that we know about holiness and what that involves in terms of its practice in the lives and so forth. There are a lot of people that know things, but they don't necessarily understand them. That the knowledge of that body of information doesn't necessarily translate itself into a life of integrity or somebody who's moral, who's ethical. And so it seems to me that the process of gaining character is a process which the scriptures identify in terms of those words. We have knowledge, we have wisdom, we have understanding, and it's wisdom that brings us, and it's personified in beautiful ways in Proverbs, I think. I was reading some of those chapters this week in chapters 8 and 9 where, you know, wisdom is personified. But wisdom, I think, provides the means through which we can apply what it is that, you know, God has revealed about Himself into a life. It's a very interesting verse. I think it's Ecclesiastes 8:1. I was just reading through Ecclesiastes, which I love the book of Ecclesiastes because you really see Solomon in a different kind of way. He makes himself very vulnerable, doesn't he, in Ecclesiastes. But there's a verse about wisdom in Ecclesiastes 8:1, which is really kind of interesting. I think validates my premise. Well, the point is that, you know, leaders have varying degrees of character. And then we have... Well, let's call them developed traits. And what I mean by developed traits are, you know, some people are known, you know, well, he's a hard worker. Or he is really prudent. And prudence is not a bad thing. And, you know, we read a lot about these developed traits in the book of Proverbs. You know, the wise man is like the ant. You know, and there's this analogy of the ant who, you know, is constantly working harder, and then you've got the sluggard who doesn't do anything. And those are choices that we make. We choose whether or not we're going to get up and work and we're going to be diligent or whatever. There are certain aspects of life over which we do have control. So if you look at an individual, regardless of that individual, they're going to fall, you know, they're going to look differently. There are things over which, I mean, there were leaders in the scriptures that were very effective. Jeroboam was a very effective leader. I mean, Jeroboam's reign in Israel, every one of his successors had the same little postscript to his life, you know, and he followed in the ways of Jeroboam, you know, who caused Israel to sin. I mean, Jeroboam was very effective. I mean, he had natural tendencies towards leadership. He obviously had some level of giftedness, and you know, in terms of his natural innate abilities to be able to lead. But he was totally corrupt, and his character led him to make decisions, you know, that were totally corrupt and led Israel down a slippery path that eventually led in its destruction. But the realities are, we all fall into that somewhere. I have discovered that in thinking about organizations, this is the little discussion I was having with the Lord this morning as I was thinking about organizations, that organizations, you know, at certain times need mobilizers. Most organizations were started by a mobilizer, somebody that had a vision, right? And they were able to communicate that vision in very, very strong communicative language and ways that people really were able to relate to. So they mobilize people. And then there comes a time when organizations, you know, need to be organized. In other words, we've got a lot of things going, and, you know, that mobilizer, you know, mobilizers may not be good organizers. Some are. When I took that little survey that we took on Monday, those of you that were in my network, I kind of ranked really high as a mobilizer, and then I kind of slipped down a little bit on the organizing scale, and everybody that knows me would say, well, Jerry's not all that organized, you know. And but I'm organized, but I'm just, it's not really one of my great strengths. And then in organized, you know, there comes a time in which ministries, you know, need to stabilize. And so the leadership needs of an organization change as it, and I'm trying to, I haven't got to this point. Maybe by next year in Chopron, I'll have this all figured out, or at least try to figure it out a little bit better, is how the leadership needs of an organization change as it goes through time, and how do you make those leadership changes in ways that are going to enable the organization to move forward and not decline, because there comes a point in time where, you know, it's a lot of organizations, there seems to be a pivotal point where either they make it or they lose it. And what that is, and I'm not sure that I understand that yet, but it's some of the things that I'm trying to grapple with now, which I have no idea whether or not that has any relevance to this discussion, but I think it's an intriguing thought that we really need to grapple with. You know, where is our organization and its history as we look at the, you know, the timeline of its history? You know, what is our leadership need right now, or how can we accommodate the needs of the organization with the resources, the leadership resources that are available? It may not mean changing the CEO, but what are our needs from a leadership standpoint that we need to bring to the table in order to take our organization forward? It's kind of an intriguing idea to think through, isn't it? Maybe, you know, you don't find it as intriguing as I do. I don't know. Okay, we spent the day kind of talking in ways that quite frankly, I'm not as comfortable with as I would be of just sitting here and sharing and dispensing information. We've had a little bit more interaction. I've tried to take a little bit of a different focus to something that has been somewhat familiar to at least some of you here. But how are you reacting to this? What do you see your needs? How can I help you? What kind of questions do you have as you find yourself in a ministry right now? How has this been helpful? I'm not looking for, you know, kudos here. What I'm asking for is, how can we take, what do we need? What's missing here, or how can we help you to leave here with a sense of direction? I think it's a combination of practice, and you're not going to, if your wife says, I wish you'd be a little bit more sensitive, and so it's not like we all of a sudden, start thinking more sensitively. I think there probably are, little, places that we hang our hat periodically, and all of a sudden we become sensitive through practice. So I think, in reality, yes, that it is something I think that I have grown into. I kind of think this way, and I kind of live within this little strange world of mine where I'm kind of constantly thinking about the application of things, and I look at things differently. I interpret things. You will be that. I will at one life kind of, and in one sense, I will have kind of affected your life, because one of the things that I know that you'll do, I've had people call me about bridging issues, for example. You'll be waiting. Every time you hear somebody presenting something now, for those of you that heard the entry bridging and conversion discussion, every time you hear somebody making a presentation, you're going to be waiting for the bridge. You're going to be waiting for, okay, all right, boy, they brought me right up to the front porch. Am I enthused or not? I am ready to go. And you're sitting there almost, and you'll find yourself getting almost a little bit angry. Like, where is it? I mean, here I am. Or maybe not angry, but frustrated, because you're wanting to take the next step, and nobody's enabling you, or nobody's helping you to do that. So I think part of it will just come out of knowledge. The other part is going to come through discernment. The other thing is going to come through practice. And so as you know it, it's kind of the knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. And I think, that process is a process that begins to occur as God throws you, new circumstances and new opportunities and new challenges to take it. It's difficult to... My wife gets irritated with me, and she says, "Don't you ever just stop? I mean, can't we have Christmas without you profiling it?" the grandkids come, and I'm sitting there saying, "Well, if this was a perfect experience for our grandkids this Christmas, what would it look like?" So I have to say it a little bit differently, because she knows exactly what I'm doing. She says, "You make Christmas a program." And I said, "Well, honey, it's, but we want the children to experience it in the ways that..." So, yeah, right. That's right. I have to remember that. I will say, "Well, honey, it's a process. We're processing here." So, at least I'll get her back a little bit. But other thoughts? Yeah, Philip. Well, first of all, I mean, there are really two choices as far as databases. You can create your own. Actually, there are probably three. You can create your own, and there are, if you have Microsoft Office Suite, Excel, or especially the Access program, is a platform on which a lot of databases have been built. Another one, which is now available in the Microsoft climate, is FileMaker Pro, which was originally designed for the Apple computer, and using that. And FileMaker Pro as a program has been a lot of programmers really like it because it's a lot easier to use than Access in developing a program. The value of developing your own program is you can make sure that you're tracking the kind of data that's unique to your organization that you want to track. In other words, you can track volunteerism, for example. You can track things. Then there are programs that are written already, you know, like ACT, which is a good starting point. If I were beginning an organization, I'd probably, you know, or just, be, you know, starting to do database, I'd probably pick up something like the program that I made reference to, ACT. It's about, in the U.S., you can buy it for about $350. It's not like it's a huge expense. And it can be programmed very, very easily to accommodate, and it can actually handle about, you know, 5 or 10,000 names, you know, pretty easily. And it has the ability of being able to send emails from it, faxes from it. You can, cooperates very, very well in the being able to merge data from other files like Excel or word processing files. So it's a powerful program, and for the price, you can't hardly go wrong. And then there are programs that have just been written for organizations, nonprofit organizations like Razor's Edge, which is a Blackbaud product. I mean, you could pay $15,000 in the U.S. for, you know, that kind of a program, and I'm not sure that it's worth it. Those of you that heard me on Monday talk about the, you know, this, it's called DO3 model, which is mobilizer, you know, organizer, stabilizer. I gave you a survey. I don't think I've got any of those surveys available. But the fellow that, let me see if I have his address here. The fellow that developed that survey has developed a software program, and he's very generous. And so you may want to just send him a note and ask him. His name is John Harrington. I think I gave you some of them. I gave you his name, but he's developed a software program around mobilize, organize, and stabilize. He's really done a very interesting thing, and actually, I think we're going to download it in our office because it meets a lot of our needs. And okay, here's his address. Let me give you. They have a website. The website is called www. Write it out here. John is just a great, great guy. I mean, I just am so impressed with this guy. He deeply loves the Lord. He came out of a business environment where he was buying and selling companies, and you know, he'd build them up and sell them, and he's kind of a turnaround specialist, and he made, you know, his millions of dollars, and now has essentially gone into working for the Lord and has begun this company. And he's got a real heart for God and a real desire to help. And he's developed this software, and he might even make it available, you know, at no cost to you. I don't know, but anyway, it's worth taking a look at. Don't say that I said he'd give it away, but say that, you know, you heard Jerry, and Jerry said that you're doing something pretty interesting in software and whatever. But software is a challenge, you know, it's a tool. And the challenge with software, you can get just really, you know, you could spend your life sitting in front of a computer just kind of playing around with data, you know, and that, you don't want to do that. And so I think that's why, you know, the organizational model that I shared with you yesterday, you know, the circle organizational chart, you know, it's finding somebody, you know, who loves to sit in front of a computer. That may be their area of giftedness. They you know, they're a stabilizer. They just love doing that. Maybe you gravitate to that. But I think, you know, part of leadership, at least in the developmental world, is understanding the role that you play and basically organizing yourself, you know, utilizing resources that are available to you so that you can maintain your focus upon what it is that God's called you to do, and that's to basically equip an organization. Because I think the developmental role, the reason why I love this profession so much, you know, usually we hire a development director as an afterthought. You know, yeah, well, we've got to have a development director. We have somebody have to worry about money. Well, the realities are the director of development, if he's doing his job well, is basically, you know, the helmsman, you know, in the ship, you know, the helmsman. I'll just call him the helmsman. But it's the one that's kind of steering the ship, you know, taking the ship to where it needs to go. And the reason that I love this profession so much is that I know that I can help organizations or help the organization with whom I'm working, you know, get to the destination. But that takes focus, and it's so easy to get distracted. I think that's the challenge that you're going to face, Tim, and others of us that face in the organization, is keeping in a focus, recognizing and understanding what the needs of the organization are, and make basically mobilizing the resources, you know, in order to get it done. So it's more than money. We have resources that go so far beyond that in terms of engaging people in the variety of ways in which they need to be engaged, maintaining those relationships, sustaining them, so that the ultimate objective is, but you're in the driver's seat. And I don't know if you feel comfortable being in the driver's seat, but I like being in the driver's seat. But I realize that that's an incredible position of responsibility, because you can steer it down the wrong road, you know, into disaster, or you can be used of God to taking it to the destination. And so I find myself, as I think the more we realize, isn't it true, the more we realize the elements of what it is that God's called us to do, the more time we spend on our face before God. I mean, I feel so incredibly inadequate at times. And I mean, honestly, I know you've been here. You know, where you just lay on the floor and you just say, God, please, somehow, you just help me to know what it is that I need to do and help me to do it well. So competency is not just an issue of head knowledge. I think the more competent we become, the more dependent we become. It's kind of interesting. We did this exercise. I don't mean to ramble, but we did this exercise in Good to Great. One of the things, that's the book, the secular book that Jim Collins wrote in Good to Great, one of the things that he recognized that all of these organizations had leaders that met a similar profile. All these organizations, I mean, here you have 11 organizations, only 11 could have been, only they could only identify 11, you know, who met the qualifications out of about 4,000 or 5,000 organizations that and every one of these 11 organizations had the same kind of leader. Every single one of them had the same kind of leader. What would you think that leader would look like? Just give me some of the qualities that you think that leader would have. Well, that's good. That's a good answer. But you know, when a lot of people think about leaders, they think about the charismatic leader, you know, the Lee Iacocca, the Jack Welch, you know, those would be names that would be used in the U.S. You know, Jack Welch was the president of, you know, General Electric, and Lee Iacocca, of course, everybody, you know, recognized him for the great turnaround that he created, you know, in terms of Chrysler Corporation, which was going downhill. But the realities are, you know, the leaders of these Good to Great organizations didn't look at all like that. They were not these charismatic, you know, mobilizers, you know, evangelists for their company, because none of those people, you know, Chrysler, after Iacocca left, you know, Chrysler had to be absorbed by Daimler-Benz in order to be able to survive. I mean, the realities are it was going right back down where it was. And so what he did was infuse, you know, change by virtue of his personality and the television. I mean, I'm sure he did things internally. I'm not suggesting that he wasn't a competent leader for what it is that he was called on to do, but he wasn't able to sustain it. Interestingly enough, the two primary qualities that were recognized by Jim Collins and those people that did the research over 5 years of time in evaluating those 11 companies, the two primary qualities, guess what they were? Incredible humility and incredible focus. Almost, you know, like a laser beam focus. But it's interesting, isn't it, that the predominant characteristic that was discernible in every one of those leaders was their humility. Isn't it fascinating? But, you know, I think competence, you know, when taken to the ultimate degree, the more competent a person becomes, if he's honestly, you know, growing in his profession and growing in his competence, the more competent a person becomes, the more he realizes, you know, his dependence, you know, and the awareness of the fact that competence alone is competence is not going to give you success by itself. And I think these people became aware of their competence as well as their incompetence, and they brought people in. And when all of these people were being interviewed, because they were all interviewed, and the book Good to Great is worth reading just on the chapter of leadership. It honestly is, because it is a fascinating analysis of leadership. But when all of them were interviewed, what did they say? They just said, first of all, they were amazed that they were being interviewed. You've got to be kidding. And then when asked the question, well, how come, you know, how did, you know, you become so successful? And the interviewers, almost to a person, said they couldn't believe the response of the people. They just said, well, out there. And basically they just motioned to all the people outside the organization, you know, their leaders, you know, the managers and so forth. These are the people that took me there. And they recognize the role that they played in the process. And I think that's true with all of us, you know, that there comes a point in time when we realize we can't do this by ourselves. And I think the more we realize, I mean, competence is almost a guise that can destroy us at one level. But I think the more people realize, you know, their competence, they realize equally their incompetence, and we realize our dependence, and then all of a sudden, you know, humility is not something you put on. Humility comes as a result of your awareness of who it is you are in the context of who it is that God is and what it is that needs to be done and so forth. And I think that brings us to a point where we do lay a lot on the floor, don't we? You know, figuratively, or on our knees, pleading with God to do what it is that only God can do. And he uses us. I mean, for some strange reason, he uses people like you and me. Go figure. I'm not sure that I can still figure that out, but I rejoice in the fact that that happens. Some other thoughts that come to your mind, or questions, or whatever. What are some of the other things that you think about? One level we all have to grapple with. I mean, the practicalities of what it is that we have to do, given the immensity or the size of our organizations, require that we become, you know, a little bit more adept in utilizing the resources that are available to us for mass communication. And of course, direct mail is one of the ways to do that. But I think, you know, I watched our president go through this process, you know, and there was a level of structure in which this process, you know, took place, but there was a very, very personal aspect of it too. I mean, he it wasn't just like he'll tell us a prayer request because we want to know that, and we figure, well, that's just really important to know. I mean, he really did become very, very intimately involved in these people. He developed some other habits. One of the things that we did, with him because he traveled a lot. And these President's Club members were all over the United States in his particular example, but he traveled a lot, so in the U.S. And so what we would do is we'd print up a zip code listing, a postal code. You know, you have postal codes, and so we'd print up a postal code listing of all the people that were on the President's Club. He'd actually keep that in his day timer or whatever you would call it, a calendar or whatever. And when he was in an airport, let's say he was flying through Chicago, he just made it a habit when he's sitting in like a lounge or whatever, waiting for the next flight to take over, he just looked through the zip codes that were, or the postal codes that were unique to Chicago or whatever, and he just call all those people. You know, I'm just traveling through Chicago, thinking about you. I thought I'd give you a buzz and see how you're doing. Technology can make it impersonal, or it can be a tool to help you to be more effective. And again, I think so much of I would be real careful not to draw too deep a line in the sand here, because we can easily ascribe something bad to technology that we've experienced as being impersonal and manipulative. And just kind of wipe it off, say, well, I'm not going to do that because it's impersonal and manipulative. When in reality, whether something's manipulative or impersonal is really more a matter of how we intended for it to be rather than for what it is in and of itself. I don't know if that makes any sense. But I struggle with a lot of things. I struggle with aid, AID, attendance, involvement, donation, because that's one way of being able to assess, cultivation levels. If somebody has attended something, they've become involved in something, and donation, they make a donation. It becomes a kind of an objective way to be able to assess something that I need to know, how well cultivated they are. So I use that instrument. And so I struggle with that a little bit because it's kind of a little gimmicky at one level, isn't it? I mean, we want to get people there. We want to get them involved and so forth. And so there's a sense of, are you not being manipulative, if in fact you realize that certain people are going to be more likely to respond to you than other people because of what it is that you do, in building the relationship. And I suppose that that's true if in fact your purpose is just to extract something from them that they may not be prepared to do. In other words, I know that if I were selling cars, let's say I'm selling Mercedes-Benz, and you have the ability to be able to buy a Mercedes. So I know that if I can get you in the car, give you the key, put you on a driving thing, and turn the radio on to a certain station so that the radio is going to just, show all of its magnificent qualities, that all of a sudden, the likelihood of you purchasing that car, providing you had the intention of doing that, exponentially went up. Is that manipulative? Well, I suppose at one level it is. But if you were a salesperson, I don't know. Do you understand where I'm going with that? I think that's the struggle. I think James talks a lot about that, and we talked a little bit about that this week, in James chapter 2, and it talks about, the rich man coming in, or the one with the dress and the fine clothes and the gold ring, and the poor man. But it seems to me that the essence of what it is that James says is basically the indifference of the church in that particular example to the poor person at the expense of the rich person for what it is that they thought the rich person could do to help them, to get wherever they perceive themselves wanting to go. And James says, have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives? In other words, the motive was, we're going to eliminate relationships with one person at the expense of pursuing them with another. And it seems to me that everybody has something to offer. My approach is that everybody, who might have an interest in our organization, regardless of whether or not they had resources, everybody has the capability of coming with us and partnering with us to accomplish the goal. And so the mystery is, how can we find out what that role might be, and how can we meaningfully engage them so that we can collectively rejoice and experience the benefit of everyone's giftedness in accomplishing the ultimate goal to which we've committed ourselves, which is transformation. And so there are some awfully difficult moral, ethical issues that we grapple with in this profession, and just stay honest to God. I mean, what can I say? You know, always, you know, make your plans and then, you know, submit them to God and pray that He'll give you the wisdom and the discernment of knowing, you know, and sometimes, you know, just responding to your gut is an important thing to do. And I've done that. You know, there's a lot of things I haven't done that, you know, I was planning to doing because I just didn't sense that God was in it in the way that I wanted Him to be. And I'd hope that he would use me to be in representing the organization. Other thoughts or questions? Well, I don't feel compelled to keep you here just because we're supposed to end at 12:30. My agenda for this meeting in terms of working through the things that I had written down as things that I wanted to communicate, you know, I have fulfilled. And so I don't feel like, you know, if you don't feel like you've been shortchanged, I don't feel like I've shortchanged you. So let's, it's been so good. I hope that we'll stay in contact. I really do. And to the extent that you feel like I can offer something or if I can provide you something that would be helpful, please, you know, don't hesitate to call. I'm going to be in many of your countries this year, which I'm thrilled. I mean, nothing could thrill me more. I'm trying to figure out how I could be in more places, and I'm, you know, that's always a wonderful challenge. But let's just stay in contact. Let's come. I hope that I'll see you next year. I hope that you put Chopron 05 on your calendar. I have, and I plan to be here. And I think every year coming back is always more fun because we're always saying, yeah, I have had people come to me this year who have just come rejoicing in what it is that, you know, the little steps of progress that have been made this year in terms of their ministry, but they realize that there's differences being made, and part of it came as a result of some of the things that we were able to talk about last year. And so that's the joy of it all. And if you're in Indianapolis, and I don't say that facetiously, if you're planning to come to the U.S. for ministry, you know, and to represent your organizations, I hope that you will, you know, make an effort to try to at least to check and see if I'm going to be home. I'm usually home every weekend. You know, I try to be. You know, church is pretty important to us, and it's a very important part of our lives. And so it would be rare if I were in the United States that I wouldn't be home on a Saturday and a Sunday. And we'd love to have you come by. That would be great. Stay with us, and you can stay as long as you want, and we've got a wonderful place to do that. We'll feed you, and we'll show you hospitality, and we'll bring you in front of as many people as we know, if we have the opportunity, have them come and let you, you know, share with them what it is that God's doing, and so we'd love to do that. Let's pray, and then we'll let you go. Father, it's been such a good day, and such a good week. We take a deep breath and a sigh, and say, Lord, thank you. It's just so good, and we're so grateful for this privilege of being together, being able to share with one another, to be able to grow with one another, to be able to bear one another's burdens, because we've done a share of that as well. We've wept, we've laughed, we've experienced the full spectrum of emotions as we've been a part of one another's lives in the ways that Chopron throws us together, and we thank you for that. And so thanks for Greg and for Richard and for Stefan and the crowd of people that work behind the scenes to make these events happen. And Lord, we would pray that you would bless them as they make their plans for next year. Watch over us as we travel. Give us journeying mercies as we go home. Help us to go back with a new vision and maybe a new direction and a new sense of what it is that you want us to do. There are people in this room that are struggling with direction, what it is you really want them to do. I just pray for my friend Philip in Australia, who just is kind of really seeking the Lord and is here really seeking the wisdom of God in terms of his life. And I just pray that you give him some real clear direction and real focus, and that you'd bless his life in ways that go so far beyond our imaginations, because he's committed himself to you and to the work, whatever that work might end up looking like. In his country. Lord, I just pray for all of us who seek the leading, your leading in all areas of our life, that you would bless us and guide us and bring us back to our families, and may we rejoice together for the opportunity that's been ours these days, for we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.